The exemplary novels of Cervantes. The Lady Cornelia. Don Antonio de Isonza and Don Juan de Gamboa, gentlemen of high birth and excellent sense, both of the same age, and very intimate friends, being students together at Salamanca, determined to abandon their studies and proceed to Flanders. To this resolution they were incited by the fervor of youth, their desire to see the world, and their conviction that the profession of arms, so becoming to all, is more particularly suitable to men of illustrious race. But they did not reach Flanders until peace was restored, or at least on the point of being concluded, and at Antwerp they received letters from their parents, wherein the latter expressed the great displeasure caused them by their sons having left their studies without informing them of their intention, which if they had done, the proper measures might have been taken for their making the journey in a manner befitting their birth and station. Unwilling to give further dissatisfaction to their parents, the young men resolved to return to Spain, the rather as there was now nothing to be done in Flanders. But before doing so they determined to visit all the most renowned cities of Italy, and having seen the greater part of them, they were so much attracted by the noble University of Bologna, that they resolved to remain there and complete the studies abandoned at Salamanca. They imparted their intentions to their parents, who testified their entire approbation by the magnificence with which they provided their sons with everything proper to their rank, to the end that, in their manner of living, they might show who they were, and of what house they were born. From the first day, therefore, that the young men visited the schools, all perceived them to be gallant, sensible, and well-bred gentlemen. Don Antonio was at this time in his 24th year, and Don Juan had not passed his 26th. This fair period of life they adorned by various good qualities. They were handsome, brave, of good address, and well versed in music and poetry. In a word, they were endowed with such advantages as caused them to be much sought and greatly beloved by all who knew them. They soon had numerous friends, not only among the many Spaniards belonging to the university, too, but also among people of the city, and of other nations, to all of whom they proved themselves courteous, liberal, and wholly free from that arrogance which is said to be too often exhibited by Spaniards. 2. Cardinal Albornoz founded a college in the University of Bologna, expressly for the Spaniards, his countrymen. Being young, and of joyous temperament, Don Juan and Don Antonio did not fail to give their attention to the beauties of the city. Many there were indeed in Bologna, both married and unmarried, remarkable as well for their virtues as their charms, but among them all there was none who surpassed the Signora Cornelia Bentivoglia, of that old and illustrious family of the Bentivogli, who were at one time lords of Bologna. Cornelia was beautiful to a marvel. She had been left under the guardianship of her brother Lorenzo Benevolio, a brave and honorable gentleman. They were orphans, but inheritors of considerable wealth, and wealth is a great alleviation of the evils of the orphan state. Cornelia lived in complete seclusion, and her brother guarded her with unwearied solicitude. The lady neither showed herself on any occasion, nor would her brother consent that anyone should see her, but this very fact inspired Don Juan and Don Antonio with the most lively desire to behold her face, were it only at church. Yet all the pains they took for that purpose proved vain, and the wishes they had felt on the subject gradually diminished, as the attempt appeared more and more hopeless. Thus, devoted to their studies, and varying these with such amusements as are permitted to their age, the young men passed a life as cheerful as it was honorable, rarely going out at night, but when they did so, it was always together and well armed. One evening, however, when Don Juan was preparing to go out, Don Antonio expressed his desire to remain at home for a short time, to repeat certain orisons, but he requested Don Juan to go without him, and promised to follow him. "Why should I go out to wait for you?" said Don Juan. "I will stay. If you do not go out at all tonight, it will be of very little consequence." "By no means shall you stay," returned Don Antonio. "Go and take the air. I will be with you almost immediately, if you take the usual way." "Well, do as you please," said Don Juan. "If you come you will find me on our usual beat." With these words Don Juan left the house. The night was dark, and the hour about 11. Don Juan passed through two or three streets, but finding himself alone, and with no one to speak to, he determined to return home. He began to retrace his steps accordingly, and was passing through a street, the houses of which had marble porticos, when he heard someone call out, "Hist! Hist!" from one of the doors. The darkness of the night, and the shadow cast by the colonnade, did not permit him to see the whisperer, but he stopped at once, and listened attentively. He saw a door partially opened, approached it, and heard these words uttered in a low voice, "Is it you, Fabio?" Don Juan, on the spur of the moment, replied, "Yes." "Take it, then," returned the voice, "take it, and place it in security, but return instantly, for the matter presses." Don Juan put out his hand in the dark, and encountered a packet. Proceeding to take hold of it, he found that it required both hands. Instinctively he extended the second, but had scarcely done so before the portal was closed, and he found himself again alone in the street, loaded with, he knew not what. Presently the cry of an infant, and, as it seemed, but newly born, smote his ears, filling him with confusion and amazement, for he knew not what next to do, or how to proceed in so strange a case. If he knocked at the door he was almost certain to endanger the mother of the infant, and if he left his birth in there, he must imperil the life of the babe itself. But if he took it home he should as little know what to do with it, nor was he acquainted with any one in the city to whom he could entrust the care of the child, yet remembering that he had been required to come back quickly, after placing his charge in safety, he determined to take the infant home, leave it in the hands of his old housekeeper, and return to see if his aid was needed in any way, since he perceived clearly that the person who had been expected to come for the child had not arrived, and the latter had been given to himself in mistake. With this determination, Don Juan soon reached his home, but found that Antonio had already left it. He then went to his chamber, and calling the housekeeper, uncovered the infant, which was one of the most beautiful ever seen, whilst, as the good woman remarked, the elegance of the clothes in which the little creature was wrapped, proved him for it was a boy to be the son of rich parents. "You must, now," said Don Juan to his housekeeper, "find someone to nurse this infant, but first of all take away these rich coverings, and put on him others of the plainest kind. Having done that, you must carry the babe, without a moment's delay, to the house of a midwife, for there it is that you will be most likely to find all that is requisite in such a case. Take money to pay what may be needful, and give the child such parents as you please, for I desire to hide the truth, and not let the manner in which I became possessed of it be known." The woman promised that she would obey him in every point, and Don Juan returned in all haste to the street, to see whether he should receive another mysterious call. But just before he arrived at the house whence the infant had been delivered to him, the clash of swords struck his ear, the sound being as that of several persons engaged in strife. He listened carefully, but could hear no word. The combat was carried on in total silence, but the sparks cast up by the swords as they struck against the stones, enabled him to perceive that one man was defending himself against several assailants, and he was confirmed in this belief by an exclamation which proceeded at length from the last person attacked. "Ah, traitors! You are many and I am but one, yet your baseness shall not avail you." Hearing and seeing this, Don Juan, listening only to the impulses of his brave heart, sprang to the side of the person assailed, and opposing the buckler he carried on his arm to the swords of the adversaries, drew his own, and speaking in Italian that he might not be known as a Spaniard, he said, "Fear not, senor, help has arrived that will not fail you while life holds. Lay on well, for traitors are worth but little however many there may be." To this, one of the assailants made answer, "You lie, there are no traitors here. He who seeks to recover his lost honor is no traitor, and is permitted to avail himself of every advantage." No more was said on either side, for the impetuosity of the assailants, who, as Don Juan thought, amounted to not less than six, left no opportunity for further words. They pressed his companion, meanwhile, very closely, and two of them giving him each a thrust at the same time with the point of their swords, he fell to the earth. Don Juan believed they had killed him, he threw himself upon the adversaries, nevertheless, and with a shower of cuts and thrusts, dealt with extraordinary rapidity, caused them to give way for several paces. But all his efforts must needs have been vain, for the defense of the fallen man, had not fortune aided him, by making the neighbors come with lights to their windows and shout for the watch, whereupon the assailants ran off and left the street clear. The fallen man was meanwhile beginning to move, for the strokes he had received, having encountered a breastplate as hard as adamant, had only stunned, but not wounded him. Now, Don Juan's hat had been knocked off in the fray, and thinking he had picked it up, he had in fact put on that of another person, without perceiving it to be other than his own. The gentleman whom he had assisted now approached Don Juan, and accosted him as follows, "Senor Cavalier, whoever you may be, I confess that I owe you my life, and I am bound to employ it, with all I have or can command, in your service. Do me the favor to tell me who you are, that I may know to whom my gratitude is due." "Senor," replied Don Juan, "that I may not seem discourteous, and in compliance with your request, although I am wholly disinterested in what I have done, you shall know that I am a Spanish gentleman, and a student in this city. If you desire to hear my name I will tell you, rather lest you should have some future occasion for my services than for any other motive, that I am called Don Juan de Gamboa." "You have done me a singular service, Senor Don Juan de Gamboa," replied the gentleman who had fallen, "but I will not tell you who I am, nor my name, which I desire that you should learn from others rather than from myself, yet I will take care that you be soon informed respecting these things." Don Juan then inquired of the stranger if he were wounded, observing that he had seen him receive two furious lunges in the breast, but the other replied that he was unhurt, adding that next to God, a famous plastron that he wore had defended him against the blows he had received, though his enemies would certainly have finished him had Don Juan not come to his aid. While thus discoursing, they beheld a body of men advancing towards them, and Don Juan exclaimed, "If these are enemies, Señor, let us hasten to put ourselves on our guard, and use our hands as men of our condition should do." "They are not enemies, so far as I can judge," replied the stranger. "The men who are now coming towards us are friends." And this was the truth. The persons approaching, of whom there were eight, surrounded the unknown cavalier, with whom they exchanged a few words, but in so low a tone that Don Juan could not hear the purport. The gentleman then turned to Don Juan and said, "If these friends had not arrived, I should certainly not have left your company, Señor Don Juan, until you had seen me in some place of safety, but as things are, I beg you now, with all kindness, to retire and leave me in this place, where it is of great importance that I should remain." Speaking thus, the stranger carried his hand to his head, but finding that he was without a hat, he turned towards the persons who had joined him, desiring them to give him one, and saying that his own had fallen. He had no sooner spoken than Don Juan presented him with that which he had himself just picked up, and which he had discovered to be not his own. The stranger, having felt the hat, returned it to Don Juan, saying that it was not his, and adding, "On your life, Señor Don Juan, keep this hat as a trophy of this affray, for I believe it to be one that is not unknown." The persons around then gave the stranger another hat, and Don Juan, after exchanging a few brief compliments with his companion, left him, in compliance with his desire, without knowing who he was. He then returned home, not daring at that moment to approach the door whence he had received the newly born infant, because the whole neighborhood had been aroused, and was in movement. Now it chanced that as Don Juan was returning to his abode, he met his comrade Don Antonio de Isenza, and the latter no sooner recognized him in the darkness, then he exclaimed, "Turn about, Don Juan, and walk with me to the end of the street. I have something to tell you, and as we go along we'll relate a story such as you have never heard before in your life." "I also have one of the same kind to tell you," returned Don Juan, "but let us go up the street as you say, and do you first relate your story." Don Antonio thereupon walked forward, and began as follows: "You must know that in little less than an hour after you had left the house, I left it also, to go in search of you. But I had not gone 30 paces from this place when I saw before me a black mass, which I soon perceived to be a person advancing in great haste. As the figure approached nearer, I perceived it to be that of a woman, wrapped in a very wide mantle, and who, in a voice interrupted by sobs and sighs, addressed me thus, 'Are you, sir, a stranger, or one of the city?' 'I am a stranger,' I replied, 'and a Spaniard.' 'Thanks be to God,' she exclaimed, 'He will not have me die without the sacraments.' 'Are you then wounded, madam?' 'Continued I, or attacked by some mortal malady?' 'It may well happen that the malady from which I suffer may prove mortal, if I do not soon receive aid,' returned the lady. 'Wherefore, by the courtesy which is ever found among those of your nation, I entreat you, Señor Spaniard, take me from these streets, and lead me to your dwelling with all the speed you may. There, if you wish it, you shall know the cause of my sufferings, and who I am, even though it should cost me my reputation to make myself known.'" Hearing this, continued Don Antonio, "and seeing that the lady was in a strait which permitted no delay, I said nothing more, but offering her my hand, I conducted her by the by streets to our house. Our page, Sandis Taban, opened the door, but, commanding him to retire, I led the lady in without permitting him to see her, and took her into my room, where she had no sooner entered than she fell fainting on my bed. Approaching to assist her, I removed the mantle which had hitherto concealed her face, and discovered the most astonishing loveliness that human eyes ever beheld. She may be about 18 years old, as I should suppose, but rather less than more. Bewildered for a moment at the sight of so much beauty, I remained as one stupefied, but recollecting myself, I hastened to throw water on her face, and, with a pitiable sigh, she recovered consciousness. The first word she uttered was the question, 'Do you know me, Señor?' I replied, 'No, lady. I have not been so fortunate as ever before to have seen so much beauty.' 'Unhappy is she,' returned the lady, 'to whom heaven has given it for her misfortune. But, Señor, this is not the time to praise my beauty, but to mourn my distress. By all that you most revere, I entreat you to leave me shut up here, and let no one behold me, while you return in all haste to the place where you found me, and see if there be any persons fighting there.' Yet do not take part either with one side or the other. Only separate the combatants, for whatever injury may happen to either, must needs be to the increase of my own misfortunes. I then left her as she desired, continued Don Antonio, and am now going to put an end to any quarrel which may arise, as the lady has commanded me. Have you anything more to say? Inquired Don Juan. Do you think I have not said enough? Answered Don Antonio, since I have told you that I have now in my chamber, and hold under my key, the most wonderful beauty that human eyes have ever beheld. The adventure is a strange one, without doubt, replied Don Juan, but listen to mine, and he instantly related to his friend all that had happened to him. He told how the newly born infant was then in their house, and in the care of their housekeeper, with the orders he had given as to changing its rich habits for others less remarkable, and for procuring a nurse from the nearest midwife, to meet the present necessity. As to the combat you come in quest of, he added, that is already ended, and peace is made. Don Juan further related that he had himself taken part in the strife, and concluded by remarking, that he believed those whom he had found engaged were all persons of high quality, as well as great courage. Each of the Spaniards was much surprised at the adventure of the other, and they instantly returned to the house to see what the lady shut up there might require. On the way, Don Antonio told Don Juan that he had promised the unknown not to suffer anyone to see her, assuring her that he only would enter the room, until she should herself permit the approach of others. I shall nevertheless do my best to see her, replied Don Juan, after what you have said of her beauty, I cannot but desire to do so, and shall contrive some means for effecting it. Saying this they arrived at their house, when one of their three pages, bringing lights, Don Antonio cast his eyes on the hat worn by Don Juan, and perceived that it was glittering with diamonds. Don Juan took it off, and then saw that the luster of which his companion spoke, proceeded from a very rich band formed of large brilliants. In great surprise, the friends examined the ornament, and concluded that if all the diamonds were as precious as they appeared to be, the hat must be worth more than 2,000 ducats. They thus became confirmed in the conviction entertained by Don Juan, that the persons engaged in the combat were of high quality, especially the gentleman whose part he had taken, and who, as he now recollected, when bidding him take the hat, and keep it, had remarked that it was not unknown. The young men then commanded their pages to retire, and Don Antonio, opening the door of his room, found the lady seated on his bed, leaning her cheek on her hand, and weeping piteously. Don Juan also having approached the door, the splendor of the diamonds caught the eye of the weeping lady, and she exclaimed, "Enter, my lord duke, enter. Why afford me in such scanty measure the happiness of seeing you? Enter at once, I beseech you." "Señora," replied Don Antonio, "there is no duke here who is declining to see you." "How, no duke?" she exclaimed. "He whom I have just seen is the Duke of Ferrara, the rich decoration of his hat does not permit him to conceal himself." "Of a truth, Señora, he who wears the hat you speak of is no duke, and if you please to undeceive yourself by seeing that person, you have but to give your permission, and he shall enter." "Let him do so," said the lady, "although, if he be not the duke, my misfortune will be all the greater." Don Juan had heard all this, and now finding that he was invited to enter, he walked into the apartment with his hat in his hand, but he had no sooner placed himself before the lady than she, seeing he was not the person she had supposed, began to exclaim, in a troubled voice and with broken words, "Ah! Miserable creature that I am, tell me, senor, tell me at once, without keeping me in suspense, what do you know of him who owned that sombrero? How is it that he no longer has it, and how did it come into your possession? Does he still live, or is this the token that he sends me of his death? Oh! My beloved, what misery is this? I see the jewels that were thine. I see myself shut up here without the light of thy presence. I am in the power of strangers, and if I did not know that they were Spaniards and gentlemen, the fear of that disgrace by which I am threatened would already have finished my life." "Calm yourself, madam," replied Don Juan, "for the master of this sombrero is not dead, nor are you in a place where any increase to your misfortunes is to be dreaded. We think only of serving you, so far as our means will permit, even to the exposing our lives for your defense and succor. It would ill become us to suffer that the trust you have in the faith of Spaniards should be vain, and since we are Spaniards, and of good quality for hear that assertion, which might otherwise appear arrogant, becomes needful be assured that you will receive all the respect which is your due." "I believe you," replied the lady, "but, nevertheless, tell me, I pray you, how this rich sombrero came into your possession, and where is its owner, who is no less a personage than Alfonso d'Este, Duke of Ferrara?" Then Don Juan, that he might not keep the lady longer in suspense, related to her how he had found the hat in the midst of a combat, in which he had taken the part of a gentleman, who, from what she had said, he could not now doubt to be the Duke of Ferrara. He further told her how, having lost his own hat in the strife, the gentleman had bidden him keep the one he had picked up, and which belonged, as he said, to a person not unknown, that neither the cavalier nor himself had received any wound, and that, finally, certain friends or servants of the former had arrived, when he who was now believed to be the Duke had requested Don Juan to leave him in that place, where he desired for certain reasons to remain. "This, madam," concluded Don Juan, "is the whole history of the manner in which the hat came into my possession, and for its master, whom you suppose to be the Duke of Ferrara, it is not an hour since I left him in perfect safety. Let this true narration suffice to console you, since you are anxious to be assured that the Duke is unhurt." To this the lady made answer, "That you, gentlemen, may know how much reason I have to inquire for the Duke, and whether I need be anxious for his safety, listen in your turn with attention, and I will relate what I know not yet if I must call my unhappy history." While these things were passing, the housekeeper of Don Antonio and Don Juan was occupied with the infant, whose mouth she had moistened with honey, and whose rich habits she was changing for clothes of a very humble character. When that was done, she was about to carry the babe to the house of the midwife, as Don Juan had recommended, but as she was passing with it before the door of the room wherein the lady was about to commence her history, the little creature began to cry aloud, insomuch that the lady heard it. She instantly rose to her feet, and set herself to listen, when the plaints of the infant arrived more distinctly to her ear. "What child is this, gentlemen?" said she, "for it appears to be but just born." Don Juan replied, "It is a little fellow who has been laid at the door of our house tonight, and our servant is about to seek someone who will nurse it." "Let them bring it to me, for the love of God," exclaimed the lady, "for I will offer their charity to the child of others, since it has not pleased heaven that I should be permitted to nourish my own." Don Juan then called the housekeeper, and taking the infant from her arms he placed it in those of the lady, saying, "Behold, madam, this is the present that has been made to us tonight, and it is not the first of the kind that we have received, since but few months pass wherein we do not find such godsends hooked onto the hinges of our doors." The lady had meanwhile taken the infant into her arms, and looked attentively at its face, but remarking the poverty of its clothing, which was, nevertheless, extremely clean, she could not restrain her tears. She cast the kerchief which she had worn around her head over her bosom, that she might succor the infant with decency, and bending her face over that of the child, she remained long without raising her head, while her eyes rained torrents of tears on the little creature she was nursing. The babe was eager to be fed, but finding that it could not obtain the nourishment it sought, the lady returned the babe to Don Juan, saying, "I have vainly desired to be charitable to this deserted infant, and have but shown that I am new to such matters. Let your servants put a little honey on the lips of the child, but do not suffer them to carry it through the streets at such an hour. Bid them wait until the day breaks, and let the babe be once more brought to me before they take it away, for I find a great consolation in the sight of it." Don Juan then restored the infant to the housekeeper, bidding her take the best care she could of it until daybreak, commanding that the rich clothes it had first worn should be put on it again, and directing her not to take it from the house until he had seen it once more. That done, he returned to the room, and the two friends being again alone with the beautiful lady, she said, "If you desire that I should relate my story, you must first give me something that may restore my strength, for I feel in much need of it." Don Antonio flew to the buffet for some conserves, of which the lady ate a little, and having drunk a glass of water, and feeling somewhat refreshed, she said, "Sit down, signors, and listen to my story." The gentlemen seated themselves accordingly, and she, arranging herself on the bed, and covering her person with the folds of her mantle, suffered the veil which she had kept about her head to fall on her shoulders, thus giving her face to view, and exhibiting in it a luster equal to that of the moon, rather of the sun itself, when displayed in all its splendor. Liquid pearls fell from her eyes, which she endeavored to dry with a kerchief of extraordinary delicacy, and with hands so white that he must have had much judgment in color who could have found a difference between them and the cambric. Finally, after many a sigh and many an effort to calm herself, with a feeble and trembling voice, she said, "I, signors, am she of whom you have doubtless heard mention in the city, since, such as it is, there are few tongues that do not publish the fame of my beauty. I am Cornelia Benevolio, sister of Lorenzo Benevolio, and, in saying this, I have perhaps affirmed two acknowledged truths, the one my nobility, and the other my beauty. At a very early age I was left an orphan to the care of my brother, who was most sedulous in watching over me, even from my childhood, although he reposed more confidence in my sentiments of honor than in the guards he had placed around me. In short, kept thus between walls and in perfect solitude, Having no other company than that of my attendants, I grew to womanhood, and with me grew the reputation of my loveliness, bruited abroad by the servants of my house, and by such as had been admitted to my privacy, as also by a portrait which my brother had caused to be taken by a famous painter, to the end, as he said, that the world might not be wholly deprived of my features, in the event of my being early summoned by heaven to a better life. All this might have ended well, had it not chanced that the Duke of Ferrara consented to act as sponsor at the nuptials of one of my cousins, when my brother permitted me to be present at the ceremony, that we might do the greater honor to our kinswoman. There I saw and was seen, there, as I believe, hearts were subjugated, and the will of the beholders rendered subservient, there I felt the pleasure received from praise, even when bestowed by flattering tongues, and, finally, I there beheld the Duke, and was seen by him. In a word, it is in consequence of this meeting that you see me here. I will not relate to you, signors, for that would needlessly protract my story, the various stratagems and contrivances by which the Duke and myself, at the end of 2 years, were at length enabled to bring about that union, our desire for which had received birth at those nuptials. Neither guards, nor seclusion, nor remonstrances, nor human diligence of any kind, sufficed to prevent it, and we were finally made one, for without the sanction due to my honor, Alfonso would certainly not have prevailed. I would fain have had him publicly demand my hand from my brother, who would not have refused it, nor would the Duke have had to excuse himself before the world as to any inequality in our marriage, since the race of the Bentivogli is in no manner inferior to that of Est, but the reasons which he gave for not doing as I wished appeared to me sufficient, and I suffered them to prevail. The visits of the Duke were made through the intervention of a servant, over whom his gifts had more influence than was consistent with the confidence reposed in her by my brother. After a time I perceived that I was about to become a mother, and feigning illness and low spirits, I prevailed on Lorenzo to permit me to visit the cousin in whose marriage it was that I first saw the Duke. I then apprised the latter of my situation, letting him also know the danger in which my life was placed from that suspicion of the truth which I could not but fear that Lorenzo must eventually entertain. It was then agreed between us, that when the time for my travail drew near, the Duke should come, with certain of his friends, and take me to Ferrara, where our marriage should be publicly celebrated. This was the night on which I was to have departed, and I was waiting the arrival of Alfonso, when I heard my brother pass the door with several other persons, all armed, as I could hear, by the noise of their weapons. The terror caused by this event was such as to occasion the premature birth of my infant, a son, whom the waiting woman, my confidant, who had made all ready for his reception, wrapped at once in the clothes we had provided, and gave at the street door, as she told me, to a servant of the Duke. Soon afterwards, taking such measures as I could under circumstances so pressing, and hastened by the fear of my brother, I also left the house, hoping to find the Duke awaiting me in the street. I ought not to have gone forth until he had come to the door, but the armed band of my brother, whose sword I felt at my throat, had caused me such terror that I was not in a state to reflect. Almost out of my senses I came forth, as you behold me, and what has since happened you know. I am here, it is true, without my husband, and without my son, yet I return thanks to heaven which has led me into your hands, for from you I promise myself all that may be expected from Spanish courtesy, reinforced, as it cannot but be in your persons, by the nobility of your race. Having said this, the lady fell back on the bed, and the two friends hastened to her assistance, fearing she had again fainted. But they found this not to be the case, she was only weeping bitterly. Wherefore Don Juan said to her, "If up to the present moment, beautiful lady, my companion Don Antonio, and I, have felt pity and regret for you as being a woman, still more shall we now do so, knowing your quality, since compassion and grief are changed into the positive obligation and duty of serving and aiding you. Take courage, and do not be dismayed, for little as you are formed to endure such trials, so much the more will you prove yourself to be the exalted person you are, as your patience and fortitude enable you to rise above your sorrows. Believe me, Senora, I am persuaded that these extraordinary events are about to have a fortunate conclusion, for heaven can never permit so much beauty to endure permanent sorrow, nor suffer your chaste purposes to be frustrated. Go now to bed, Senora, and take that care of your health of which you have so much need. There shall presently come to wait on you a servant of ours, in whom you may confide as in ourselves, for she will maintain silence respecting your misfortunes with no less discretion than she will attend to all your necessities." "The condition in which I find myself," replied the lady, "might compel me to the adoption of more difficult measures than those you advise. Let this woman come, signors, presented to me by you, she cannot fail to be good and serviceable, but I beseech you let no other living being see me." "So shall it be," replied Don Antonio, and the two friends withdrew, leaving Cornelia alone. Don Juan then commanded the housekeeper to enter the room, taking with her the infant, whose rich habits she had already replaced. The woman did as she was ordered, having been previously told what she should reply to the questions of the senora respecting the infant she bore in her arms. Seeing her come in, Cornelia instantly said, "You come in good time, my friend, give me that infant, and place the light near me." The servant obeyed, and, taking the babe in her arms, Cornelia instantly began to tremble, gazed at him intently, and cried out in haste, "Tell me, good woman, is this child the same that you brought me a short time since?"
"It is the same, senora," replied the woman.
"How is it, then, that his clothing is so different?"
"Certainly, dame housekeeper, either these are other wrappings, or the infant is not the same."
"It may all be as you say," began the old woman.
"All as I say," interrupted Cornelia. "How and what is this?
I conjure you, friend, by all you most value, to tell me whence you received these rich clothes, for my heart seems to be bursting in my bosom.
Tell me the cause of this change, for you must know that these things belong to me, if my sight do not deceive me, and my memory have not failed. In these robes, or some like them, I entrusted to a servant of mine the treasured jewel of my soul. Who has taken them from him? Ah, miserable creature that I am! Who has brought these things here? Oh, unhappy and woeful day!"
Don Juan and Don Antonio, who were listening to all this, could not suffer the matter to go further, nor would they permit the exchange of the infant's dress to trouble the poor lady any longer. They therefore entered the room, and Don Juan said, "This infant and its wrappings are yours, senora," and immediately he related from point to point how the matter had happened. He told Cornelia that he was himself the person to whom the waiting woman had given the child, and how he had brought it home, with the orders he had given to the housekeeper respecting its change of clothes, and his motives for doing so. He added that, from the moment when she had spoken of her own infant, he had felt certain that this was no other than her son, and if he had not told her so at once, that was because he feared the effects of too much gladness, coming immediately after the heavy grief which her trials had caused her. The tears of joy then shed by Cornelia were many and long continued. Infinite were the acknowledgments she offered to heaven, innumerable the kisses she lavished on her son, and profuse the thanks which she offered from her heart to the two friends, whom she called her guardian angels on earth, with other names, which gave abundant proof of her gratitude. They soon afterwards left the lady with their housekeeper, whom they enjoined to attend her well, and do her all the service possible, having made known to the woman the position in which Cornelia found herself, to the end that she might take all necessary precautions, the nature of which, she, being a woman, would know much better than they could do. They then went to rest for the little that remained of the night, intending to enter Cornelia's apartment no more, unless summoned by herself, or called thither by some pressing need. The day having dawned, the housekeeper went to fetch a woman, who agreed to nurse the infant in silence and secrecy. Some hours later the friends inquired for Cornelia, and their servant told them that she had rested a little. Don Juan and Don Antonio then went to the schools. As they passed by the street where the combat had taken place, and near the house whence Cornelia had fled, they took care to observe whether any signs of disorder were apparent, and whether the matter seemed to be talked of in the neighborhood, but they could hear not a word respecting the affray of the previous night, or the absence of Cornelia. So, having duly attended the various lectures, they returned to their dwelling. The lady then caused them to be summoned to her chamber, but finding that, from respect to her presence, they hesitated to appear, she replied to the message they sent her, with tears in her eyes, begging them to come and see her, which she declared to be now the best proof of their respect as well as interest, since, if they could not remedy, they might at least console her misfortunes. Thus exhorted, the gentleman obeyed, and Cornelia received them with a smiling face and great cordiality. She then entreated that they would do her the kindness to walk about the city, and ascertain if anything had transpired concerning her affairs. They replied, that they had already done so, with all possible care, but that not a word had been said reacting the matter. At this moment, one of the three pages who served the gentleman approached the door of the room, telling his masters from without, that there was then at the street door, attended by two servants, a gentleman, who called himself Lorenzo Benevolio, and inquired for the Signor Don Juan de Gamboa. Hearing this message, Cornelia clasped her hands, and placing them on her mouth, she exclaimed, in a low and trembling voice, while her words came with difficulty through those clenched fingers, "It is my brother, signors. It is my brother. Without doubt he has learned that I am here, and has come to take my life. Help and aid, signors. Help and aid."
"Calm yourself, lady," replied Don Antonio, "you are in a place of safety, and with people who will not suffer the smallest injury to be offered you. The Señor Don Juan will go to inquire what this gentleman demands, and I will remain to defend you, if need be, from all disturbance." Don Juan prepared to descend accordingly, and Don Antonio, taking his loaded pistols, bade the pages belt on their swords, and hold themselves in readiness for whatever might happen. The housekeeper, seeing these preparations, began to tremble. Cornelia, dreading some fearful result, was in grievous terror. Don Juan and Don Antonio alone preserved their coolness. Arrived at the door of the house, Don Juan found Don Lorenzo, who, coming towards him, said, "I entreat your lordship, for such is the form of address among Italians, I entreat your lordship to do me the kindness to accompany me to the neighboring church. I have to speak to you respecting an affair which concerns my life and honor." "Very willingly," replied Don Juan. "Let us go, Señor, wherever you please." They walked side by side to the church, where they seated themselves on a retired bench, so as not to be overheard. Don Lorenzo was the first to break silence. "Señor Spaniard," he said, "I am Lorenzo Benevolio, if not of the richest, yet of one of the most important families belonging to this city, and if this seem like boasting of myself, the notoriety of the fact may serve as my excuse for naming it. I was left an orphan many years since, and to my guardianship was left a sister, so beautiful, that if she were not nearly connected with me, I might perhaps describe her in terms that, while they might seem exaggerated, would yet not by any means do justice to her attractions. My honor being very dear to me, and she being very young, as well as beautiful, I took all possible care to guard her at all points, but my best precautions have proved vain. The self-will of Cornelia, for that is her name, has rendered all useless. In a word, and not to weary you, for this story might become a long one, I will but tell you, that the Duke of Ferrara, Alfonso d'Este, vanquishing the eyes of Argus by those of a lynx, has rendered all my cares vain, by carrying off my sister last night from the house of one of our kindred, and it is even said that she has already become a mother. The misfortune of our house was made known to me last night, and I instantly placed myself on the watch. Nay, I met and even attacked Alfonso, sword in hand, but he was succored in good time by some angel, who would not permit me to efface in his blood the stain he has put upon me. My relation has told me, and it is from her I have heard all, that the Duke deluded my sister, under a promise to make her his wife, but this I do not believe, for, in respect to present station and wealth, the marriage would not be equal, although, in point of blood, all the world knows how noble are the Bentivogli of Bologna. What I fear is, that the Duke has done, what is but too easy when a great and powerful prince desires to win a timid and retiring girl. He has merely called her by the tender name of wife, and made her believe that certain considerations have prevented him from marrying her at once, a plausible pretense, but false and perfidious. Be that as it may, I see myself at once deprived of my sister and my honor. Up to this moment I have kept the matter secret, purposing not to make known the outrage to anyone, until I see whether there may not be some remedy, or means of satisfaction to be obtained. It is better that a disgrace of this kind be supposed and suspected, than certainly and distinctly known, seeing that between the yes and the no of a doubt, each inclines to the opinion that most attracts him, and both sides of the question find defenders. Considering all these things, I have determined to repair to Ferrara, and there demand satisfaction from the Duke himself. If he refuse it, I will then offer him defiance. Yet my defiance cannot be made with armed bands, for I could neither get them together nor maintain them but as from man to man. For this it is, then, that I desire your aid. I hope you will accompany me in the journey. Nay, I am confident that you will do so, being a Spaniard and a gentleman, as I am told you are. I cannot entrust my purpose to any relation or friend of my family, knowing well that from them I should have nothing more than objections and remonstrances, while from you I may hope for sensible and honorable counsels, even though there should be peril in pursuing them. You must do me the favor to go with me, Señor. Having a Spaniard, and such as you appear to be, at my side, I shall account myself to have the armies of Xerxes. I am asking much at your hands, but the duty of answering worthily to what fame publishes of your nation, would oblige you to do still more than I ask." "No more, Señor Lorenzo," exclaimed Don Juan, who had not before interrupted the brother of Cornelia, "no more. From this moment I accept the office you propose to me, and will be your defender and counselor. I take upon myself the satisfaction of your honor, or due vengeance for the affront you have received, not only because I am a Spaniard, but because I am a gentleman, and you another, so noble, as you have said, as I know you to be, and as, indeed, all the world reputes you. When shall we set out? It would be better that we did so immediately, for a man does ever well to strike while the iron is hot. The warmth of anger increases courage, and a recent affront more effectually awakens vengeance. Hearing this, Don Lorenzo rose and embraced Don Juan, saying to him, "A person so generous as yourself, Señor Don Juan, needs no other incentive than that of the honor to be gained in such a cause. This honor you have assured to yourself today, if we come out happily from our adventure, but I offer you an additional I can do, or am worth. Our departure I would have to be tomorrow, since I can provide all things needful today." "This appears to me well decided," replied Don Juan, "but I must beg you, Señor Don Lorenzo, to permit me to make all known to a gentleman who is my friend, and of whose honor and silence I can assure you even more certainly than of my own, if that were possible." "Since you, Señor Don Juan," replied Lorenzo, "have taken charge, as you say, of my honor, dispose of this matter as you please, and make it known to whom and in what manner it shall seem best to you. How much more, then, to a companion of your own, for what can he be but everything that is best?" This said, the gentlemen embraced each other and took leave, after having agreed that on the following morning Lorenzo should send to summon Don Juan at an hour fixed on when they should mount their horses and pursue their journey in the disguise that Don Lorenzo had selected. Don Juan then returned, and gave an account of all that had passed to Don Antonio and Cornelia, not omitting the engagement into which he had entered for the morrow. "Good heavens, Señor!" exclaimed Cornelia, "what courtesy! What confidence! To think of your committing yourself without hesitation to an undertaking so replete with difficulties! How can you know whether Lorenzo will take you to Ferrara, or to what place indeed he may conduct you? But go with him whither you may, be certain that the very soul of honor and good faith will stand beside you. For myself, unhappy creature that I am, I shall be terrified at the very atoms that dance in the sunbeams, and tremble at every shadow, but how can it be otherwise, since on the answer of Duke Alfonso depends my life or death? How do I know that he will reply with sufficient courtesy to prevent the anger of my brother from passing the limits of discretion? And if Lorenzo should draw the sword, think ye he will have a despicable enemy to encounter? Must not I remain through all the days of your absence in a state of mortal suspense and terror, awaiting the favorable or grievous intelligence that you shall bring me? Do I love either my brother or the Duke so little as not to tremble for both, and not feel the injury of either to my soul?" "Your fears affect your judgment, Señora Cornelia," replied Don Juan, "and they go too far. Amidst so many terrors, you should give some place to hope, and trust in God. Put some faith also in my care, and in the earnest desire I feel to see your affairs attain to a happy conclusion. Your brother cannot avoid making this journey to Ferrara, nor can I excuse myself from accompanying him thither. For the present we do not know the intentions of the Duke, nor even whether he be or be not acquainted with your elopement. All this we must learn from his own mouth, and there is no one who can better make the inquiry than myself. Be certain, Señora, that the welfare and satisfaction of both your brother and the Señor Duke are to me as the apples of my eyes, and that I will care for the safety of the one as of the other." "Ah, Señor Don Juan," replied Cornelia, "if heaven grant you as much power to remedy, as grace to console misfortune, I must consider myself exceedingly fortunate in the midst of my sorrows, and now would I fain see you gone and returned, for the whole time of your absence I must pass suspended between hope and fear." The determination of Don Juan was approved by Don Antonio, who commended him for the justification which he had thereby given to the confidence of Lorenzo Benvolio. He furthermore told his friend that he would gladly accompany him, to be ready for whatever might happen, but Don Juan replied not so, first, because you must remain for the better security of the Lady Cornelia, whom it will not be well to leave alone, and secondly, because I would not have Señor Lorenzo suppose that I desire to avail myself of the arm of another. "But my arm is your own," returned Don Antonio, "wherefore, if I must even disguise myself, and can but follow you at a distance, I will go with you, and as to Señora Cornelia, I know well that she will prefer to have me accompany you, seeing that she will not here want people who can serve and guard her." "Indeed," said Cornelia, "it will be a great consolation to me to know that you are together, señors, or at least so near as to be able to assist each other in case of necessity, and since the undertaking you are going on appears to be dangerous, do me the favor, gentlemen, to take these relics with you." Saying this, Cornelia drew from her bosom a diamond cross, of great value, with an onuse of gold equally rich and costly. The two gentlemen looked at the magnificent jewels, which they esteemed to be of still greater value than the decoration of the hat, but they returned them to the lady, each saying that he carried relics of his own, which, though less richly decorated, were at least equally efficacious. Cornelia regretted much that they would not accept those she offered, but she was compelled to submit. The housekeeper was now informed of the departure of her masters, though not of their destination, or of the purpose for which they went. She promised to take the utmost care of the lady, whose name she did not know, and assured her masters that she would be so watchful as to prevent her suffering in any manner from their absence. Early the following morning Lorenzo was at the door, where he found Don Juan ready. The latter had assumed a traveling dress, with the rich sombrero presented by the Duke, and which he had adorned with black and yellow plumes, placing a black covering over the band of brilliants. He went to take leave of Cornelia, who, knowing that her brother was near, fell into an agony of terror, and could not say one word to the two friends who were bidding her adieu. Don Juan went out the first, and accompanied Lorenzo beyond the walls of the city, where they found their servants waiting with the horses in a retired garden. They mounted, rode on before, and the servants guided their masters in the direction of Ferrara by ways but little known. Don Antonio followed on a low pony, and with such a change of apparel as sufficed to disguise him, but fancying that they regarded him with suspicion, especially Lorenzo, he determined to pursue the highway, and rejoin his friend in Ferrara, where he was certain to find him with but little difficulty. The Spaniards had scarcely got clear of the city before Cornelia had confided her whole history to the housekeeper, informing her that the infant belonged to herself and to the Duke of Ferrara, and making her acquainted with all that has been related, not concealing from her that the journey made by her masters was to Ferrara, or that they went accompanied by her brother, who was going to challenge the Duke Alfonso. Hearing all this, the housekeeper, as though the devil had sent her to complicate the difficulties and defer the restoration of Cornelia, began to exclaim, "Alas! Lady of my soul! All these things have happened to you, and you remain carelessly there with your limbs stretched out, and doing nothing. Either you have no soul at all, or you have one so poor and weak that you do not feel it. And do you really suppose that your brother has gone to Ferrara? Believe nothing of the kind, but rather be sure that he has carried off my masters, and wiled them from the house, that he may return and take your life, for he can now do it as one would drink a cup of water. Consider only under what kind of guard and protection we are left that of three pages, who have enough to do with their own pranks, and are little likely to put their hands to anything good. I, for my part, shall certainly not have courage to await what must follow, and the destruction that cannot but come upon this house." The Signor Lorenzo, an Italian, to put his trust in Spaniards, and ask help and favor from them. By the light of my eyes, I will believe none of that. So saying, she made a fig tree, at herself. But if you, my daughter, will take good advice, I will give you such as shall truly enlighten your way. 3. A gesture of contempt or playfulness, as the case may be, and which consists in a certain twist of the fingers and thumb. Cornelia was thrown into a pitiable state of alarm and confusion by these declarations of the housekeeper, who spoke with so much heat, and gave so many evidences of terror, that all she said appeared to be the very truth. The lady pictured to herself Don Antonio and Don Juan as perhaps already dead. She fancied her brother even then coming in at the door, and felt herself already pierced by the blows of his poniard. She therefore replied, "What advice do you then give me, good friend, that may prevent the catastrophe which threatens us?" "I will give you counsel so good," rejoined the housekeeper, "that better could not be. I, Signora, was formerly in the service of a priest, who has his abode in a village not more than 2 miles from Ferrara. He is a good and holy man, who will do whatever I require from him, since he is under more obligations to me than merely those of a master to a faithful servant. Let us go to him. I will seek someone who shall conduct us thither instantly, and the woman who comes to nurse the infant is a poor creature, who will go with us to the end of the world. And, now make ready, Signora, for supposing you are to be discovered, it would be much better that you should be found under the care of a good priest, old and respected, than in the hands of 2 young students, bachelors and Spaniards, who, as I can myself bear witness, are but little disposed to lose occasions for amusing themselves. Now that you are unwell, they treat you with respect, but if you get well and remain in their clutches, heaven alone will be able to help you, for truly, if my cold disdain and repulses had not been my safeguard, they would long since have torn my honor to rags. All is not gold that glitters. Men say one thing, but think another. Happily, it is with me that they have to do, and I am not to be deceived, but know well when the shoe pinches my foot. Above all, I am well born, for I belong to the Crivellis of Milan, and I carry the point of honor 10,000 feet above the clouds. By this you may judge, Signora, through what troubles I have had to pass, since, being what I am, I have been brought to serve as the housekeeper of Spaniards, or as, what they call, their gouvernante. Not that I have, in truth, any complaint to make of my masters, who are a couple of half-saints for, when they are not put into a rage. And, in this respect, they would seem to be biscuits, as, indeed, they say they are. But, after all, They may be Galicians, which is another nation, and much less exact than the Biscayans, neither are they so much to be depended on as the people of the Bay. 4. The original is Benditos, which sometimes means simpleton, but is here equivalent to the Italian Beato, and must be rendered as in the text. By all this verbiage, and more beside, the bewildered lady was induced to follow the advice of the old woman, insomuch that, in less than 4 hours after the departure of the friends, their housekeeper making all arrangements, and Cornelia consenting, the latter was seated in a carriage with the nurse of the babe, and without being heard by the pages they set off on their way to the curate's village. All this was done not only by the advice of the housekeeper, but also with her money, for her masters had just before paid her a year's wages, and therefore it was not needful that she should take a jewel which Cornelia had offered her for the purposes of their journey. Having heard Don Juan say that her brother and himself would not follow the highway to Ferrara, but proceed thither by retired paths, Cornelia thought it best to take the high road. She bade the driver go slowly, that they might not overtake the gentleman in any case, and the master of the carriage was well content to do as they liked, since they had paid him as he liked. We will leave them on their way, which they take with as much boldness as good direction, and let us see what happened to Don Juan de Gamboa and Signor Lorenzo Benevolio. On their way they heard that the Duke had not gone to Ferrara, but was still at Bologna, wherefore, abandoning the round they were making, they regained the high road, considering that it was by this the Duke would travel on his return to Ferrara. Nor had they long entered thereon before they perceived a troop of men on horseback coming as it seemed from Bologna. Don Juan then begged Lorenzo to withdraw to a little distance, since, if the Duke should chance to be of the company approaching, it would be desirable that he should speak to him before he could enter Ferrara, which was but a short distance from them. Lorenzo complied, and as soon as he had withdrawn, Don Juan removed the covering by which he had concealed the rich ornament of his hat, but this was not done without some little indiscretion, as he was himself the first to admit some time after. Meanwhile the travelers approached, among them came a woman on a pied horse, dressed in a traveling habit, and her face covered with a silk mask, either to conceal her features, or to shelter them from the effects of the sun and air. Don Juan pulled up his horse in the middle of the road, and remained with his face uncovered, awaiting the arrival of the cavalcade. As they approached him, the height, good looks, and spirited attitude of the Spaniard, the beauty of his horse, his peculiar dress, and, above all, the luster of the diamonds on his hat, attracted the eyes of the whole party but especially those of the Duke of Ferrara, the principal personage of the group, who no sooner beheld the band of brilliants than he understood the cavalier before him to be Don Juan de Gamboa, his deliverer in the combat frequently alluded to. So well convinced did he feel of this, that, without further question, he rode up to Don Juan, saying, "I shall certainly not deceive myself, Senior Cavalier, if I call you Don Juan de Gamboa, for your spirited looks, and the decoration you wear on your hat, alike assure me of the fact." "It is true that I am the person you say," replied Don Juan. "I have never yet desired to conceal my name, but tell me, Senior, who you are yourself, that I may not be surprised into any discourtesy." "Discourtesy from you, Senior, would be impossible," rejoined the Duke. "I feel sure that you could not be discourteous in any case, but I hasten to tell you, nevertheless, that I am the Duke of Ferrara, and a man who will be bound to do you service all the days of his life, since it is but a few nights since you gave him that life which must else have been lost." Alfonso had not finished speaking, when Don Juan, springing lightly from his horse, hastened to kiss the feet of the Duke, but, with all his agility, the latter was already out of the saddle, and alighted in the arms of the Spaniard. Seeing this, Signor Lorenzo, who could but observe these ceremonies from a distance, believed that what he beheld was the effect of anger rather than courtesy. He therefore put his horse to its speed, but pulled up midway on perceiving that the Duke and Don Juan were of a verity clasped in each other's arms. It then chanced that Alfonso, looking over the shoulders of Don Juan, perceived Lorenzo, whom he instantly recognized, and somewhat disconcerted at his appearance, while still holding Don Juan embraced, he inquired if Lorenzo Benevolio, whom he there beheld, had come with him or not. Don Juan replied, "Let us move somewhat apart from this place, and I will relate to your excellency some very singular circumstances." The Duke having done as he was requested, Don Juan said to him, "My lord Duke, I must tell you that Lorenzo Benevolio, whom you there see, has a cause of complaint against you, and not a light one. He avers that some night since you took his sister, the Lady Cornelia, from the house of a lady, her cousin, and that you have deceived her, and dishonored his house. He desires therefore to know what satisfaction you propose to make for this, that he may then see what it behoves him to do. He has begged me to be his aid and mediator in the matter, and I have consented with a good will, since, from certain indications which he gave me, I perceive that the person of whom he complained, and yourself, to whose liberal courtesy I owe this rich ornament, were one and the same. Thus, seeing that none could more effectually mediate between you than myself, I offered to undertake that office willingly, as I have said, and now I would have you tell me, Signor, if you know aught of this matter, and whether what Lorenzo has told me be true. Alas, my friend, it is so true, replied the Duke, that I durst not deny it, even if I would. Yet I have not deceived or carried off Cornelia, although I know that she has disappeared from the house of which you speak. I have not deceived her, because I have taken her for my wife, and I have not carried her off, since I do not know what has become of her. If I have not publicly celebrated my nuptials with her, it is because I waited until my mother, who is now at the last extremity, should have passed to another life, she desiring greatly that I should espouse the Signora Olivia, daughter of the Duke of Mantua. There are, besides, other reasons, even more important than this, but which it is not convenient that I should now make known. What has in fact happened is this: on the night when you came to my assistance, I was to have taken Cornelia to Ferrara, she being then in the last month of her pregnancy, and about to present me with that pledge of our love with which it has pleased God to bless us, but whether she was alarmed by our combat or by my delay, I know not. All I can tell you is, that when I arrived at the house, I met the confidant of our affection just coming out. From her I learned that her mistress had that moment left the house, after having given birth to a son, the most beautiful that ever had been seen, and whom she had given to one Fabio, my servant. The woman is she whom you see here. Fabio is also in this company, but of Cornelia and her child I can learn nothing. These 2 days I have passed at Bologna, in ceaseless endeavors to discover her, or to obtain some clue to her retreat, but I have not been able to learn anything. In that case, interrupted Don Juan, if Cornelia and her child were now to appear, you would not refuse to admit that the first is your wife, and the second your son? Certainly not, replied the Duke, for if I value myself on being a gentleman, still more highly do I prize the title of Christian. Cornelia, besides, is one who well deserves to be mistress of a kingdom. Let her but come, and whether my mother live or die, the world shall know that I maintain my faith, and that my word, given in private, shall be publicly redeemed. And what you have now said to me you are willing to repeat to your brother, Signor Lorenzo? Inquired Don Juan. My only regret is, exclaimed the Duke, that he has not long before been acquainted with the truth. Hearing this, Don Juan made sign to Lorenzo that he should join them, which he did, alighting from his horse and proceeding towards the place where his friends stood, but far from hoping for the good news that awaited him. The Duke advanced to receive him with open arms, and the first word he uttered was to call him brother. Lorenzo scarcely knew how to reply to a reception so courteous and a salutation so affectionate. He stood amazed, and before he could utter a word, Don Juan said to him, "The Duke, Signor Lorenzo, is but too happy to admit his affection for your sister, the Lady Cornelia, and, at the same time, he assures you, that she is his legitimate consort. This, as he now says it to you, he will affirm publicly before all the world, when the moment for doing so has arrived. He confesses, moreover, that he did propose to remove her from the house of her cousin some nights since, intending to take her to Ferrara, there to await the proper time for their public espousals, which he has only delayed for just causes, which he has declared to me. He describes the conflict he had to maintain against yourself, and adds, that when he went to seek Cornelia, he found only her waiting woman, Sulpicia, who is the woman you see yonder. From her he has learned that her lady had just given birth to a son, whom she entrusted to a servant of the Duke, and then left the house in terror, because she feared that you, Signor Lorenzo, had been made aware of her secret marriage. The lady hoped, moreover, to find the Duke awaiting her in the street. But it seems that Sulpicia did not give the babe to Fabio, but to some other person instead of him, and the child does not appear, neither is the Lady Cornelia to be found, in spite of the Duke's researches. He admits that all these things have happened by his fault, but declares that whenever your sister shall appear, he is ready to receive her as his legitimate wife. Judge, then, Signor Lorenzo, if there be any more to say or to desire beyond the discovery of those two dear but unfortunate ones, the lady and her infant. To this Lorenzo replied by throwing himself at the feet of the Duke, who raised him instantly. From your greatness and Christian uprightness, most noble lord and dear brother, said Lorenzo, my sister and I had certainly nothing less than this high honor to expect. Saying this, tears came to his eyes, and the Duke felt his own becoming moist, for both were equally affected, the one with the fear of having lost his wife, the other by the generous candor of his brother-in-law, but at once perceiving the weakness of thus displaying their feelings, they both restrained themselves, and drove back those witnesses to their source, while the eyes of Don Juan, shining with gladness, seemed almost to demand from them the obsequious 5, of good news, seeing that he believed himself to have both Cornelia and her son in his own house. 5, albricias, larges. Give reward for good tidings. Things were at this point when Don Antonio de Isunza, whom Don Juan recognized at a considerable distance by his horse, was perceived approaching. He also recognized Don Juan and Lorenzo, but not the Duke, and did not know what he was to do, or whether he ought to rejoin his friend or not. He therefore inquired of the Duke's servants who the gentleman was, then standing with Lorenzo and Don Juan. They replied that it was the Duke of Ferrara, and Don Antonio, knowing less than ever what it was best for him to do, remained in some confusion, until he was relieved from it by Don Juan, who called him by his name. Seeing that all were on foot, Don Antonio also dismounted, and, approaching the group, was received with infinite courtesy by the Duke, to whom Don Juan had already named him as his friend. Finally, Don Antonio was made acquainted with all that had taken place before his arrival. Rejoicing greatly at what he heard, Don Antonio then said to his comrade, "Why, Señor Don Juan, do you not finish your work, and raise the joy of these señores to its acme, by requiring from them the albricias for discovering the Lady Cornelia and her son? Had you not arrived, I might have taken those albricias you speak of," replied Don Juan, "but now they are yours, Don Antonio, for I am certain that the Duke and Señor Lorenzo will give them to you most joyfully." The Duke and Lorenzo, hearing of Cornelia being found, and of albricias, inquired the meaning of those words. "What can it be," replied Don Antonio, "if not that I also design to become one of the personages in this happily terminating drama, being he who is to demand the albricias for the discovery of the Lady Cornelia and her son, who are both in my house?" He then at once related to the brothers, point by point, what has been already told, intelligence which gave the Duke and Lorenzo so much pleasure, that each embraced one of the friends with all his heart, Lorenzo throwing himself into the arms of Don Juan, and the Duke into those of Don Antonio, the latter promising his whole dukedom for albricias, and Lorenzo his life, soul, and estates. They then called the woman who had given the child to Don Juan, and she having perceived her master, Lorenzo Benevolio, came forward, trembling. Being asked if she could recognize the man to whom she had given the infant, she replied that she could not, but that when she had asked if he were Fabio, he had answered yes, and that she had entrusted the babe to his care in the faith of that reply. "All this is true," returned Don Juan, "and you furthermore bade me deposit the child in a place of security, and instantly return." "I did so," replied the waiting woman, weeping. But the Duke exclaimed, "We will have no more tears, all is gladness and joy. I will not now enter Ferrara, but return at once to Bologna, for this happiness is but in shadow until made perfect by the sight of Cornelia herself." Then, without more words, the whole company wheeled round, and took their way to Bologna. Don Antonio now rode forward to prepare the Lady Cornelia, lest the sudden appearance of her brother and the Duke might cause too violent a revulsion, but not finding her as he expected, and the pages being unable to give him any intelligence respecting her, he suddenly found himself the saddest and most embarrassed man in the world. Learning that the gouvernante had departed, he was not long in conjecturing that the lady had disappeared by her means. The pages informed him that the housekeeper had gone on the same day with himself and Don Juan, but as to that Lady Cornelia, respecting whom he inquired, they had never seen her. Don Antonio was almost out of his senses at this unexpected occurrence, which, he feared, must make the Duke consider himself and Don Juan to be mere liars and boasters. He was plunged in these sad thoughts when Alfonso entered with Lorenzo and Don Juan, who had spurred on before the attendants by retired and unfrequented streets. They found Don Antonio seated with his head on his hand, and as pale as a man who has been long dead, and when Don Juan inquired what ailed him, and where was the Lady Cornelia, he replied, "Rather ask me what do I not ail, since the Lady Cornelia is not to be found. She quitted the house, on the same day as ourselves, with the gouvernante we left to keep her company." This sad news seemed as though it would deprive the Duke of life, and Lorenzo of his senses. The whole party remained in the utmost consternation and dismay, when one of the pages said to Don Antonio in a whisper, "Señor, Sandis Taben, Señor Don Juan's page, has had locked up in his chamber, from the day when your worships left, a very pretty woman, whose name is certainly Cornelia, for I have heard him call her so." Plunged into a new embarrassment, Don Antonio would rather not have found the lady at all, for he could not but suppose it was she whom the page had shut up in his room than have discovered her in such a place. Nevertheless, without saying a word, He ascended to the page's chamber, but found the door fast, for the young man had gone out, and taken away the key. Don Antonio therefore put his lips to the keyhole, and said in a low voice, "Open the door, Signora Cornelia, and come down to receive your brother, and the Duke, your husband, who are waiting to take you hence." A voice from within replied, "Are you making fun of me? It is certain that I am neither so ugly nor so old but that dukes and counts may very well be looking for me, but this comes of condescending to visit pages." These words quite satisfied Don Antonio that it was not the Lady Cornelia who had replied. At that moment Son Esteban returned and went up to his chamber, where he found Don Antonio, who had just commanded that all the keys of the house should be brought, to see if any one of them would open the door. The page fell on his knees, and held up the key, exclaiming, "Have mercy on me, your worship, your absence, or rather my own villainy, made me bring this woman to my room, but I entreat your grace, Don Antonio, as you would have good news from Spain, that you suffer the fault I have committed to remain unknown to my master, Don Juan. If he be not yet informed of it, I will turn her out this instant." "What is the name of this woman?" inquired Don Antonio. "Cornelia," replied Son Esteban. Downstairs at once went the page who had discovered the hidden woman, and who was not much of a friend to Son Esteban, and entered the room where sat the Duke, Don Juan, and Lorenzo, and, either from simplicity or malice, began to talk to himself, saying, "Well caught, brother page. By heaven they have made you give up your Lady Cornelia. She was well hidden, to be sure, and no doubt my gentleman would have liked to see the master's remain away that he might enjoy himself some 3 or 4 days longer." "What is that you are saying?" cried Lorenzo, who had caught a part of these words. "Where is the Lady Cornelia?" "She is above," replied the page, and the Duke, who supposed that his consort had just made her appearance, had scarcely heard the words before he rushed from the apartment like a flash of lightning, and, ascending the staircase at a bound, gained the chamber into which Don Antonio was entering. "Where is Cornelia? Where is the life of my life?" he exclaimed, as he hurried into the room. "Cornelia is here," replied a woman who was wrapped in a quilt taken from the bed with which she had concealed her face. "Lord bless us," she continued, "one would think an ox had been stolen. Is it a new thing for a woman to visit a page, that you make such a fuss about it?" Lorenzo, who had now entered the room, angrily snatched off the sheet and exposed to view a woman still young and not ill-looking, who hid her face in her hands for shame, while her dress, which served her instead of a pillow, sufficiently proved her to be some poor castaway. The Duke asked her, was it true her name was Cornelia? "It was," she replied, adding, that she had very decent parents in the city, but that no one could venture to say, "Of this water I will never drink." The Duke was so confounded by all he beheld, that he was almost inclined to think the Spaniards were making a fool of him. But, not to encourage so grievous a suspicion, he turned away without saying a word. Lorenzo followed him, they mounted their horses and rode off, leaving Don Juan and Don Antonio even more astonished and dismayed than himself. The two friends now determined to leave no means untried, possible or impossible, to discover the retreat of the Lady Cornelia, and convince the Duke of their sincerity and uprightness. They dismissed Son Esteban for his misconduct, and turned the worthless Cornelia out of the house. Don Juan then remembered that they had neglected to describe to the Duke those rich jewels wherein Cornelia carried her relics, with the unuse she had offered to them, and they went out proposing to mention that circumstance, so as to prove to Alfonso that the lady had, indeed, been in their care, and that if she had now disappeared, it was not by any fault of theirs. They expected to find the Duke in Lorenzo's house, but the latter informed them that Alfonso had been compelled to leave Bologna, and had returned to Ferrara, having committed the search for Cornelia to his care. The friends having told him what had brought them, Lorenzo assured them that the Duke was perfectly convinced of their rectitude in the matter, adding, that they both attributed the flight of Cornelia to her great fear, but hoped, and did not doubt, that heaven would permit her reappearance before long, since it was certain that the earth had not swallowed the housekeeper, the child, and herself. With these considerations they all consoled themselves, determining not to make search by any public announcement, but secretly, since, with the exception of her cousin, no person was yet acquainted with the disappearance of Cornelia, and Lorenzo judged that a public search might prove injurious to his sister's name among such as did not know the whole circumstances of the case, since the labor of effacing such suspicions as might arise would be infinite, and by no means certain of success. The Duke meanwhile continued his journey to Ferrara, and favoring fortune, which was now preparing his happiness, led him to the village where dwelt that priest in whose house Cornelia, her infant, and the housekeeper, were concealed. The good father was acquainted with the whole history, and Cornelia had begged his advice as to what it would be best for her to do. Now this priest had been the preceptor of a duke, and to his dwelling, which was furnished in a manner befitting that of a rich and learned clerk, the duke was in the habit of occasionally repairing from Ferrara, and would thence go to the chase, or amuse himself with the pleasant conversation of his host, and with the knowledge and excellence of which the good priest gave evidence in all he did or said. The priest was not surprised to receive a visit from the duke, because, as we have said, it was not the first by many, but he was grieved to see him sad and dejected, and instantly perceived that his whole soul was absorbed in some painful thought. As to Cornelia, having been told that the duke was there, she was seized with renewed terror, not knowing how her misfortunes were to terminate. She wrung her hands, and hurried from one side of her apartment to the other, like a person who had lost her senses. Fain would the troubled lady have spoken to the priest, but he was in conversation with the duke, and could not be approached. Alfonso was meanwhile saying to him, "I come to you, my father, full of sadness, and will not go to Ferrara today, but remain your guest, give orders for all my attendants to proceed to the city, and let none remain with me but Fabio." The priest went to give directions accordingly, as also to see that his own servants made due preparations, and Cornelia then found an opportunity for speaking to him. She took his two hands and said, "Ah, my father, and dear sir, what has the duke come for? For the love of God, see what can be done to save me. I pray you, seek to discover what he proposes. As a friend, do for me whatever shall seem best to your prudence and great wisdom." The priest replied, "Duke Alfonso has come to me in deep sadness, but up to this moment he has not told me the cause. What I would have you now do is to dress this infant with great care, put on it all the jewels you have with you, more especially such as you may have received from the duke himself, leave the rest to me, and I have hope that heaven is about to grant us a happy day." Cornelia embraced the good man, and kissed his hand, and then retired to dress and adorn the babe, as he had desired. The priest, meanwhile, returned to entertain the duke with conversation while his people were preparing their meal, and in the course of their colloquy he inquired if he might venture to ask him the cause of his grief, since it was easy to see at the distance of a league that something gave him sorrow. "Father," replied the duke, "it is true that the sadness of the heart rises to the face, and in the eyes may be read the history of that which passes in the soul, but for the present I cannot confide the cause of my sorrow to any one." "Then we will not speak of it further, my lord duke," replied the priest, "but if you were in a condition permitting you to examine a curious and beautiful thing, I have one to show you which I cannot but think would afford you great pleasure." "He would be very unwise," returned Alfonso, "who, when offered a solace for his suffering, refuses to accept it. Wherefore show me what you speak of, father. The object is doubtless an addition to one of your curious collections, and they have all great interest in my eyes." The priest then rose, and repaired to the apartment where Cornelia was awaiting him with her son, whom she had adorned as he had suggested, having placed on him the relics and anus, with other rich jewels, all gifts of the duke to the babe's mother. Taking the infant from her hands, the good priest then went to the duke, and telling him that he must rise and come to the light of the window, he transferred the babe from his own arms into those of Alfonso, who could not but instantly remark the jewels, and perceiving that they were those which he had himself given to Cornelia, he remained in great surprise. Looking earnestly at the infant, meanwhile, he fancied he beheld his own portrait, and full of admiration, he asked the priest to whom the child belonged, remarking, that from its decorations and appearance one might take it to be the son of some princess. "I do not know," replied the priest, "to whom it belongs. All I can tell you is, that it was brought to me some nights since by a cavalier of Bologna, who charged me to take good care of the babe and bring it up heedfully, since it was the son of a noble and valiant father, and of a mother highly born as well as beautiful. With the cavalier there came also a woman to suckle the infant, and of her I have inquired if she knew anything of the parents, but she tells me that she knows nothing whatever. Yet of a truth, if the mother possessed but half the beauty of the nurse, she must be the most lovely woman in Italy." "Could I not see her?" asked the duke. "Yes, certainly you may see her," returned the priest. "You have only to come with me, and if the beauty and decorations of the child surprise you, I think the sight of the nurse cannot fail to produce an equal effect." The priest would then have taken the infant from the duke, but Alfonso would not let it go. He pressed it in his arms, and gave it repeated kisses. The good father, meanwhile, hastened forward, and bade Cornelia approach to receive the duke. The lady obeyed, her emotion giving so rich a color to her face that the beauty she displayed seemed something more than human. The duke, on seeing her, remained as if struck by a thunderbolt, while she, throwing herself at his feet, sought to kiss them. The duke said not a word, but gave the infant to the priest, and hurried out of the apartment. Shocked at this, Cornelia said to the priest, "Alas, dear father, have I terrified the Duke with the sight of my face? Am I become hateful to him? Has he forgot the ties by which he has bound himself to me? Will he not speak one word to me? Was his child such a burden to him that he has thus rejected him from his arms?" To all these questions the good priest could give no reply, for he too was utterly confounded by the Duke's hasty departure, which seemed more like a flight than anything else. Meanwhile Alfonso had but gone out to summon Fabio. "Ride, Fabio, my friend," he cried, "ride for your life to Bologna, and tell Lorenzo Benevolio that he must come with all speed to this place, let him make no excuse, and bid him bring with him the two Spanish gentlemen, Don Juan de Gamboa and Don Antonio de Isenza. Return instantly, Fabio, but not without them, for it concerns my life to see them here." Fabio required no further pressing, but instantly carried his master's commands into effect. The Duke returned at once to Cornelia, caught her in his arms, mingled his tears with hers, and kissed her 1,000 times, and long did the fond pair remain thus silently locked in each other's embrace, both speechless from excess of joy. The nurse of the infant and the dame, who proclaimed herself a Crivella, beheld all this from the door of the adjoining apartment, and fell into such ecstasies of delight that they knocked their heads against the wall, and seemed all at once to have gone out of their wits. The priest bestowed 1,000 kisses on the infant, whom he held on one arm, while with his right hand he showered no end of benedictions on the noble pair. At length his reverence's housekeeper, who had been occupied with her culinary preparations, and knew nothing of what had occurred, entered to notify to her master that dinner was on the table, and so put an end to this scene of rapture. The Duke then took his babe from the arms of the priest, and kept it in his own during the repast, which was more remarkable for neatness and good taste than for splendor. While they were at table, Cornelia related to the Duke all that had occurred until she had taken refuge with the priest, by the advice of the housekeeper of those two Spanish gentlemen, who had protected and guarded her with such assiduous and respectful kindness. In return the Duke related to her all that had befallen himself during the same interval, and the two housekeepers, who were present, received from him the most encouraging promises. All was joy and satisfaction, and nothing more was required for the general happiness, save the arrival of Lorenzo, Don Antonio, and Don Juan. They came on the third day, all intensely anxious to know if the Duke had received intelligence of Cornelia, seeing that Fabio, who did not know what had happened, could tell them nothing on that subject. The Duke received them alone in the antechamber, but gave no sign of gladness in his face, to their great grief and disappointment. Bidding them be seated, Alfonso himself sat down, and thus addressed Lorenzo, "You well know, Signor Lorenzo Benevolio, that I never deceived your sister, as my conscience and heaven itself can bear witness. You know also the diligence with which I have sought her, and the wish I have felt to have my marriage with her celebrated publicly. But she is not to be found, and my word cannot be considered eternally engaged to a shadow. I am a young man, and am not so blasé as to leave ungathered such pleasures as I find on my path. Before I had ever seen Cornelia I had given my promise to a peasant girl of this village, but whom I was tempted to abandon by the superior charms of Cornelia, giving therein a great proof of my love for the latter, in defiance of the voice of my conscience. Now, therefore, since no one can marry a woman who does not appear, and it is not reasonable that a man should eternally run after a wife who deserts him, lest he should take to his arms one who abhors him, I would have you consider, Signor Lorenzo, whether I can give you any further satisfaction for an affront which was never intended to be won, and further, I would have you give me your permission to accomplish my first promise, and solemnize my marriage with the peasant girl, who is now in this house." While the Duke spoke this, Lorenzo's frequent change of color, and the difficulty with which he forced himself to retain his seat, gave manifest proof that anger was taking possession of all his senses. The same feelings agitated Don Antonio and Don Juan, who were resolved not to permit the Duke to fulfill his intention, even should they be compelled to prevent it by depriving him of life. Alfonso, reading these resolves in their faces, resumed, "Endeavor to calm yourself, Signor Lorenzo, and before you answer me one word, I will have you see the beauty of her whom I desire to take to wife, for it is such that you cannot refuse your consent, and it might suffice, as you will acknowledge, to excuse a graver error than mine." So saying, the Duke rose, and repaired to the apartment where Cornelia was awaiting him in all the splendor of her beauty and rich decorations. No sooner was he gone than Don Juan also rose, and laying both hands on the arms of Lorenzo's chair, he said to him, "By Saint James of Galicia, by the true faith of a Christian, and by my honor as a gentleman, Signor Lorenzo, I will as readily allow the Duke to fulfill his project as I will become a worshipper of Muhammad. Here, in this spot, he shall yield up his life at my hands, or he shall redeem the promise given to your sister, the Lady Cornelia. At the least, he shall give us time to seek her, and until we know to a certainty that she is dead, he shall not marry."
"That is exactly my own view," replied Lorenzo.
"And I am sure," rejoined Don Juan, "that it will be the determination of my comrade, Don Antonio, likewise." While they were thus speaking, Cornelia appeared at the door between the Duke and the priest, each of whom led her by one hand. Behind them came Sulpicia, her waiting woman, whom the Duke had summoned from Ferrara to attend Our Lady, with the infant's nurse, and the Spaniard's housekeeper. When Lorenzo saw his sister, and had assured himself it was indeed Cornelia, for at first the apparently impossible character of the occurrence had forbidden his belief, he staggered on his feet, and cast himself at those of the Duke, who, raising him, placed him in the arms of his delighted sister, whilst Don Juan and Don Antonio hastily applauded the Duke for the clever trick he had played upon them all. Alfonso then took the infant from Sulpicia, and, presenting it to Lorenzo, he said, "Signor and brother, receive your nephew, my son, and see whether it please you to give permission for the public solemnization of my marriage with this peasant girl, the only one to whom I have ever been betrothed." To repeat the replies of Lorenzo would be never to make an end, and the rather if to these we added the questions of Don Juan, the remarks of Don Antonio, the expressions of delight uttered by the priest, the rejoicing of Sulpicia, the satisfaction of the housekeeper who had made herself the counselor of Cornelia, the exclamations of the nurse, and the astonishment of Fabio, with the general happiness of all. The marriage ceremony was performed by the good priest, and Don Juan de Gamboa gave away the bride, but it was agreed among the parties that this marriage also should be kept secret, until he knew the result of the malady under which the Duchess Dowager was laboring. For the present, therefore, it was determined that Cornelia should return to Bologna with her brother. All was done as thus agreed on, and when the Duchess Dowager died, Cornelia made her entrance into Ferrara, rejoicing the eyes of all who beheld her. The mourning weeds were exchanged for festive robes, the two housekeepers were enriched, and Sulpicia was married to Fabio. For Don Antonio and Don Juan, they were sufficiently rewarded by the services they had rendered to the Duke, who offered them two of his cousins in marriage, with rich dowries. But they replied, that the gentlemen of the Biscayne nation married for the most part in their own country, wherefore, not because they despised so honorable a proffer, which was not possible, but that they might not depart from a custom so laudable, they were compelled to decline that illustrious alliance, and the rather as they were still subject to the will of their parents, who had, most probably, already affianced them. The Duke admitted the validity of their excuses, but, availing himself of occasions warranted by custom and courtesy, he found means to load the two friends with rich gifts, which he sent from time to time to their house in Bologna. Many of these were of such value, that although they might have been refused for fear of seeming to receive a payment, yet the appropriate manner in which they were presented, and the particular periods at which Alfonso took care that they should arrive, caused their acceptance to be easy, not to say inevitable. Such, for example, were those dispatched by him at the moment of their departure for their own country, and those which he gave them when they came to Ferrara to take their leave of him. At this period, the Spanish gentleman found Cornelia the mother of two little girls, and the Duke more enamored of his wife than ever. The Duchess gave the diamond cross to Don Juan, and the gold anus to Don Antonio, both of whom had now no choice but to accept them. They finally arrived without accident in their native Spain, where they married rich, noble, and beautiful ladies, and they never ceased to maintain a friendly correspondence with the Duke and Duchess of Ferrara, and with Lorenzo Benevolio, to the great satisfaction of all parties, Rinconete and Cortadio, or Peter of the Corner and Little Cutter. At the venta or hostelry of the Mulinillo, which is situate on the confines of the renowned plain of Alcudia, and on the road from Castile to Andalusia, two striplings met by chance on one of the hottest days of summer. One of them was about 14 or 15 years of age, the other could not have passed his 17th year. Both were well formed, and of comely features, but in very ragged and tattered plight. Cloaks they had none, their breeches were of linen, and their stockings were merely those bestowed on them by nature. It is true they boasted shoes, one of them wore alpargates, six, or rather dragged them along at his heels, the other had what might as well have been shackles for all the good they did the wearer, being rent in the uppers, and without soles. Their respective headdresses were a Montera 7, and a miserable sombrero, low in the crown and wide in the brim. On his shoulder, and crossing his breast like a scarf, one of them carried a shirt, the color of chamois leather. The body of this garment was rolled up and thrust into one of its sleeves, the other, though traveling without encumbrance, bore on his chest what seemed a large pack, but which proved, on closer inspection, to be the remains of a starched ruff, now stiffened with grease instead of starch, and so worn and frayed that it looked like a bundle of hemp. 6. The alpargates are a kind of sandal made of cord. 7. Montera, a low cap, without visor or front to shade the eyes. Within this collar, wrapped up and carefully treasured, was a pack of cards, excessively dirty, and reduced to an oval form by repeated paring of their dilapidated corners. The lads were both much burned by the sun, their hands were anything but clean, and their long nails were edged with black. One had a dudgeon dagger by his side, the other a knife with a yellow handle. These gentlemen had selected for their siesta the porch or penthouse commonly found before a venta, and, finding themselves opposite each other, he who appeared to be the elder said to the younger, "Of what country is your worship, noble sir, and by what road do you propose to travel?" "What is my country, Senor Cavalier?" returned the other. "I know not, nor yet which way my road lies." "Your worship, however, does not appear to have come from heaven," rejoined the elder, "and as this is not a place wherein a man can take up his abode for good, you must, of necessity, be going further." "That is true," replied the younger. "I have, nevertheless, told you only the veritable fact, for as to my country, it is mine no more, since all that belongs to me there is a father who does not consider me his child, and a stepmother who treats me like a son-in-law. With regard to my road, it is that which chance places before me, and it will end wherever I may find someone who will give me the wherewithal to sustain this miserable life of mine." "Is your worship acquainted with any craft?" inquired the first speaker. "With none," returned the other, "except that I can run like a hare, leap like a goat, and handle a pair of scissors with great dexterity." "These things are all very good, useful, and profitable," rejoined the elder. "You will readily find the sacristan of some church who will give your worship the offering bread of All Saints' Day, for cutting him his paper flowers to decorate the monument 8, on Holy Thursday. 8. The monument is a sort of temporary theater, erected in the churches during Passion Week, and on which the Passion of the Savior is represented." "But that is not my manner of cutting," replied the younger. "My father, who, by God's mercy, is a tailor and hose maker, taught me to cut out that kind of spatterdashes properly called polenas, which, as your worship knows, cover the fore part of the leg and come down over the instep. These I can cut out in such style, that I could pass an examination for the rank of master in the craft, but my ill luck keeps my talents in obscurity." "The common lot, senor, of able men," replied the first speaker, "for I have always heard that it is the way of the world to let the finest talents go to waste, but your worship is still at an age when this evil fortune may be remedied, and the rather since, if I mistake not, and my eyes do not deceive me, you have other advantageous qualities which it is your pleasure to keep secret." "It is true that I have such," returned the younger gentleman, "but they are not of a character to be publicly proclaimed, as your worship has very judiciously observed." "But I," rejoined the elder, "may with confidence assure you, that I am one of the most discreet and prudent persons to be found within many a league. In order to induce your worship to open your heart and repose your faith on my honor, I will enlist your sympathies by first laying bare my own bosom, for I imagine that fate has not brought us together without some hidden purpose. Nay, I believe that we are to be true friends from this day to the end of our lives." "I, then, Senor Hidalgo, am a native of Fuenfrida, a place very well known, indeed renowned for the illustrious travelers who are constantly passing through it. My name is Pedro del Rincón, 9, my father is a person of quality, and a minister of the Holy Crusade, since he holds the important charge of a bolero or boldero, 10, as the vulgar call it. I was for some time his assistant in that office, and acquitted myself so well, that in all things concerning the sale of bulls I could hold my own with any man, though he had the right to consider himself the most accomplished in the profession. But one day, having placed my affections on the money produced by the bulls, rather than on the bulls themselves, I took a bag of crowns to my arms, and we two departed together for Madrid." 9. Peter of the Corner, Rincón meaning a corner, or obscure nook. 10. The Spanish authorities, under the pretext of being at perpetual war with infidels, still cause bulls of the crusade, to the possession of which certain indulgences are attached, to be publicly sold in obscure villages. The product of these sales was originally expended on the wars with the Moors, but from the time when Granada fell into the hands of the Spaniards, it has been divided between the church and state. The bulls are carried about by hawkers, who are called boleros. Virdo. In that city, such are the facilities that offer themselves, I soon gutted my bag, and left it with as many wrinkles as a bridegroom's pocket handkerchief. The person who was charged with the collection of the money, hastened to track my steps. I was taken, and met with but scant indulgence, only, In consideration of my youth, their worships the judges contented themselves with introducing me to the acquaintance of the whipping post, to have the flies whisked from my shoulders for a certain time, and commanding me to abstain from revisiting the court and capital during a period of 4 years. I took the matter coolly, bent my shoulders to the operation performed at their command, and made so much haste to begin my prescribed term of exile, that I had no time to procure sumpter mules, but contented myself with selecting for my valuables such as seemed most important and useful. I did not fail to include this pack of cards among them. Here the speaker exhibited that oviform specimen already mentioned, and with these I have gained my bread among the inns and taverns between Madrid and this place, by playing at Van Etten. It is true they are somewhat soiled and worn, as your worship sees, but for him who knows how to handle them, they possess a marvelous virtue, which is, that you never cut them but you find an ace at the bottom. If your worship then is acquainted with the game, you will see what an advantage it is to know for certain that you have an ace to begin with, since you may count it either for 1 or 11, and so you may be pretty sure that when the stakes are laid at 21, your money will be much disposed to stay at home. In addition to this, I have acquired the knowledge of certain mysteries regarding lansquenet and reverses, from the cook of an ambassador who shall be nameless, insomuch that, even as your worship might pass as master in the cutting of spatterdashes, so could I, too, take my degrees in the art of flat catching. With all these acquirements, I am tolerably sure of not dying from hunger, since, even in the most retired farmhouse I come to, there is always someone to be found who will not refuse himself the recreation of a few moments at cards. We have but to make a trial where we are, let us spread the net, and it will go hard with us if some bird out of all the muleteers standing about do not fall into it. I mean to say, that if we two begin now to play at Van Etten as though we were in earnest, someone will probably desire to make a third, and, in that case, he shall be the man to leave his money behind him. With all my heart, replied the younger lad, and I consider that your excellency has done me a great favor by communicating to me the history of your life. You have thereby made it impossible for me to conceal mine, and I will hasten to relate it as briefly as possible. Here it is, then, dash. I was born at Pedrazu, a village situate between Salamanca and Medina del Campo. My father is a tailor, as I have said, and taught me his trade, but from cutting with the scissors I preceded my natural abilities coming in aid to the cutting of purses. The dull, mean life of the village, and the unloving conduct of my mother-in-law, were besides but little to my taste. I quitted my birthplace, therefore, repaired to Toledo to exercise my art, and succeeded in it to admiration, for there is not a reliquary suspended to the dress, not a pocket, however carefully concealed, but my fingers shall probe its contents, or my scissors snip it off, though the owner were guarded by the eyes of Argus. During 4 months I spent in Toledo, I was never trapped between two doors, nor caught in the fact, nor pursued by the runners of justice, nor blown upon by an informer. It is true that, 8 days ago, a double spy 11, did set forth my distinguished abilities to the corregidor, and the latter, taking a fancy to me from his description, desired to make my acquaintance, but I am a modest youth, and do not wish to frequent the society of personages so important. Wherefore I took pains to excuse myself from visiting him, and departed in so much haste, that I, like yourself, had no time to procure sumpter mules or small change, nay, I could not even find a return chaise, nor so much as a cart. 11. An alguazil, who, while in the service of justice, is also in that of the thieves. He betrays them, nevertheless, whenever it suits his purpose to do so. Console yourself for these omissions, replied Pedro del Rincon, and since we now know each other, let us drop these grand and stately airs, and confess frankly that we have not a blessed farthing between us, nor even shoes to our feet. Be it so, returned Diego Cortado, for so the younger boy called himself. Be it so, and since our friendship, as your worship Señor Rincon is pleased to say, is to last our whole lives, let us begin it with solemn and laudable ceremonies, saying which, Diego rose to his feet, and embraced the Señor Rincon, who returned the compliment with equal tenderness and emotion. They then began to play at Van Etten with the cards above described, which were certainly free from dust and straw, 12, as we say, but by no means free from grease and knavery, and after a few deals, Cortado could turn up an ace as well as Rincon his master. When things had attained this point, it chanced that a muleteer came out at the porch, and, as Rincon had anticipated, he soon proposed to make a third in their game. 12, clean from dust and straw. Limpios de polvo y paja is a phrase equivalent to free of the king's dues. To this they willingly agreed, and in less than half an hour they had won from him 12 reals and 22 maravedis, which he felt as sorely as 12 stabs with a dagger and 22,000 sorrows. Presuming that the young chaps would not venture to defend themselves, he thought to get back his money by force, but the two friends laying hands promptly, the one on his dudgeon dagger and the other on his yellow-handled knife, gave the muleteer so much to do, that if his companions had not hastened to assist him, he would have come badly out of the quarrel. At that moment there chanced to pass by a company of travelers on horseback, who were going to make their siesta at the hostelry of the Alcalde, about half a league farther on. Seeing the affray between the muleteer with two boys, they interposed, and offered to take the latter in their company to Seville, if they were going to that city. "That is exactly where we desire to go," exclaimed Rincon, "and we will serve your worships in all that it shall please you to command." Whereupon, without more ado, they sprang before the mules, and departed with the travelers, leaving the muleteer despoiled of his money and furious with rage, while the hostess was in great admiration of the finished education and accomplishments of the two rogues, whose dialogue she had heard from beginning to end, while they were not aware of her presence. When the hostess told the muleteer that she had heard the boys say the cards they played with were false, the man tore his beard for rage, and would have followed them to the other venta, in the hope of recovering his property, for he declared it to be a serious affront, and a matter touching his honor, that two boys should have cheated a grown man like him. But his companions dissuaded him from doing what they declared would be nothing better than publishing his own folly and incapacity, and their arguments, although they did not console the muleteer, were sufficient to make him remain where he was. Meanwhile Cortado and Rincon displayed so much zeal and readiness in the service of the travelers, that the latter gave them a lift behind them for the greater part of the way. They might many a time have rifled the portmanteaus of their temporary masters, but did not, lest they should thereby lose the happy opportunity of seeing Seville, in which city they greatly desired to exercise their talents. Nevertheless, as they entered Seville, which they did at the hour of evening prayer, and by the gate of the custom house, on account of the dues to be paid, and the trunks to be examined, Cortado could not refrain from making an examination, on his own account, of the valise which a Frenchman of the company carried with him on the croup of his mule. With his yellow-handled weapon, therefore, he gave it so deep and broad a wound in the side that its very entrails were exposed to view, and he dexterously drew forth two good shirts, a sundial, and a memorandum book, things that did not greatly please him when he had leisure to examine them. Thinking that since the Frenchman carried that valise on his own mule, it must needs contain matters of more importance than those he had captured, Cortado would fain have looked further into it, but he abstained, as it was probable that the deficiency had been already discovered, and the remaining effects secured. Before performing this feat the friends had taken leave of those who had fed them on their journey, and the following day they sold the two shirts in the old clothes market, which is held at the gate of the Almacen or Arsenal, obtaining 20 reals for their booty. Having dispatched this business, they went to see the city, and admired the great magnificence and vast size of its principal church, and the vast concourse of people on the quays, for it happened to be the season for loading the fleet. There were also 6 galleys on the water, at sight of which the friends could not refrain from sighing, as they thought the day might come when they should be clapped on board one of those vessels for the remainder of their lives. They remarked the large number of basket boys, porters, and sea, who went to and fro about the ships, and inquired of one among them what sort of a trade it was, whether it was very laborious, and what were the gains. An Asturian, of whom they made the inquiry, gave answer to the effect that the trade was a very pleasant one, since they had no harbor dues to pay, and often found themselves at the end of the day with 6 or 7 reals in their pocket, with which they might eat, drink, and enjoy themselves like kings. Those of his calling, he said, had no need to seek a master to whom security must be given, and you could dine when and where you please, since, in the city of Seville, there is not an eating house, however humble, where you will not find all you want at any hour of the day. The account given by the Asturian was by no means discouraging to the two friends, neither did his calling seem amiss to them, nay, rather, it appeared to be invented for the very purpose of enabling them to exercise their own profession in secrecy and safety, on account of the facilities it offered for entering houses. They consequently determined to buy such things as were required for the instant adoption of the new trade, especially as they could enter upon it without undergoing any previous scrutiny. In reply to their further inquiries, the Asturian told them that it would be sufficient if each had a small porter's bag of linen, either new or second-hand, so it was but clean, with 3 palm baskets, 2 large and 1 small, wherein to carry the meat, fish, and fruit purchased by their employers, while the bag was to be used for carrying the bread. He took them to where all these things were sold. They supplied themselves out of the plunder of the Frenchmen, and in less than 2 hours they might have been taken for regular graduates in their new profession, so deftly did they manage their baskets, and so jauntily carry their bags. Their instructor furthermore informed them of the different places at which they were to make their appearance daily, in the morning at the Shambles, and at the Market of St. Salvador, on fast days at the Fish Market, every afternoon on the Quay, and on Thursdays at the Fair. All these lessons the two friends carefully stored in their memory, and the following morning both repaired in good time to the Market of St. Salvador. Scarcely had they arrived before they were remarked by numbers of young fellows of the trade, who soon perceived, by the shining brightness of their bags and baskets, that they were new beginners. They were assailed with 1,000 questions, to all which they replied with great presence of mind and discretion. Presently up came 2 customers, one of whom had the appearance of a student, the other was a soldier. Both were attracted by the clean and new appearance of their baskets, and he who seemed to be a student beckoned Cortado, while the soldier engaged Rincon. "In God's name be it." 13, exclaimed both the novices in a breath, Rincon adding, "It is a good beginning of the trade, master, since it is your worship that is giving me my handsel." "The handsel shall not be a bad one," replied the soldier, "seeing that I have been lucky at cards of late, and am in love. I propose this day to regale the friends of my lady with a feast, and am come to buy the materials." "Load away, then, your worship," replied Rincon, "and lay on me as much as you please, for I feel courage enough to carry off the whole market. Nay, if you should desire me to aid in cooking what I carry, it shall be done with all my heart." 13. This is a formula used in Spain by those who do a thing for the first time, Virdo. The soldier was pleased with the boy's ready goodwill, and told him that if he felt disposed to enter his service he would relieve him from the degrading office he then bore, but Rincon declared, that since this was the first day on which he had tried it, he was not willing to abandon the work so soon, or at least until he had seen what profit there was to be made of it, but if it did not suit him, he gave the gentleman his word that he would prefer the service offered him even to that of a canon. The soldier laughed, loaded him well, and showed him the house of his lady, bidding him observe it well that he might know it another time, so that he might be able to send him there again without being obliged to accompany him. Rincon promised fidelity and good conduct, the soldier gave him 3 quartos, 14, and the lad returned like a shot to the market, that he might lose no opportunity by delay. Besides, he had been well advised in respect of diligence by the Asturian, who had likewise told him that when he was employed to carry small fish, such as sprats, sardines, or flounders, he might very well take a few for himself and have the first taste of them, were it only to diminish his expenses of the day, but that he must do this with infinite caution and prudence, lest the confidence of the employers should be disturbed, for to maintain confidence was above all things important in their trade. 14. The quarto contains 4 maravedis. But whatever haste Rincon had made to return, he found Cortado at his post before him. The latter instantly inquired how he had got on. Rincon opened his hand and showed the 3 quartos, when Cortado, thrusting his arm into his bosom, drew forth a little purse which appeared to have once been of amber-colored silk, and was not badly filled. "It was with this," said he, "that my service to his reverence the student has been rewarded with this and 2 quartos besides. Do you take it, Rincon, for fear of what may follow?" Cortado had scarcely given the purse in secret to his companion, before the student returned in a great heat, and looking in mortal alarm. He no sooner set eyes on Cortado, than, hastening towards him, he inquired if he had by chance seen a purse with such and such marks and tokens, and which had disappeared, together with 15 crowns in gold pieces, 3 double reals, and a certain number of maravedis and quartos and octavos. "Did you take it for me yourself," he added, "while I was buying in the market, with you standing beside me?" To this Cortado replied with perfect composure, "All I can tell you of your purse is, that it cannot be lost, unless, indeed, your worship has left it in bad hands." "That is the very thing, sinner that I am," returned the student. "To a certainty I must have left it in bad hands, since it has been stolen from me." "I say the same," rejoined Cortado, "but there is a remedy for every misfortune excepting death. The best thing your worship can do now is to have patience, for after all it is God who has made us, and after one day there comes another. If one hour gives us wealth, another takes it away, but it may happen that the man who has stolen your purse may in time repent, and may return it to your worship, with all the interest due on the loan." "The interest I will forgive him," exclaimed the student, and Cortado resumed, "There are, besides, those letters of excommunication, the Paulinas, 15, and there is also good diligence in seeking for the thief, which is the mother of success. Of a truth, sir, I would not willingly be in the place of him who has stolen your purse, For if your worship have received any of the sacred orders, I should feel as if I had been guilty of some great crime, nay of sacrilege, in stealing from your person. 15. Pauline as are the letters of excommunication dispatched by the ecclesiastical courts for the discovery of such things as are supposed to be stolen or maliciously concealed. Most certainly the thief has committed a sacrilege, replied the student, in pitiable tones, for although I am not in orders, but am only a sacristan of certain nuns, yet the money in my purse was the third of the income due from a chapelry, which I had been commissioned to receive by a priest, who is one of my friends, so that the purse does, in fact, contain blessed and sacred money. Let him eat his sin with his bread, exclaimed Rincon at that moment, I should be sorry to become bail for the profit he will obtain from it. There will be a day of judgment at the last, when all things will have to pass, as they say, through the holes of the colander, and it will then be known who is the scoundrel that has had the audacity to plunder and make off with the whole third of the revenue of a chapelry. But tell me, Mr. Sacristan, on your life, what is the amount of the whole yearly income?
Income to the devil, and you with it.
16, replied the sacristan, with more rage than was becoming, am I in a humor to talk to you about income? Tell me, brother, if you know anything of the purse, if not, God be with you, I must go and have it cried.
16. This footnote is missing from the printed edition.
That does not seem to me so bad a remedy, remarked Cortado, but I warn your worship not to forget the precise description of the purse, nor the exact sum that it contains, for if you commit the error of a single mite, the money will never be suffered to appear again while the world is a world, and that you may take for a prophecy. I am not afraid of committing any mistake in describing the purse, returned the sacristan, for I remember it better than I do the ringing of my bells, and I shall not commit the error of an atom. Saying this, he drew a laced handkerchief from his pocket to wipe away the perspiration which rained down his face as from an alembic, but no sooner had Cortado set eyes on the handkerchief, than he marked it for his own. When the sacristan had got to a certain distance, therefore, Cortado followed, and having overtaken him as he was mounting the steps of a church, he took him apart, and poured forth so interminable a string of rigmarole, all about the theft of the purse, and the prospect of recovering it, that the poor sacristan could do nothing but listen with open mouth, unable to make head or tail of what he said, although he made him repeat it two or three times. Cortado meanwhile continued to look fixedly into the eyes of the sacristan, whose own were riveted on the face of the boy, and seemed to hang, as it were, on his words. This gave Cortado an opportunity to finish his job, and having cleverly whipped the handkerchief out of the pocket, he took leave of the sacristan, appointing to meet him in the evening at the same place, for he suspected that a certain lad of his own height and the same occupation, who was a bit of a thief, had stolen the purse, and he should be able to ascertain the fact in a few days, more or less. Somewhat consoled by this promise, the sacristan took his leave of Cortado, who then returned to the place where Rincon had privily witnessed all that had passed. But a little behind him stood another basket boy, who had also seen the whole transaction, and at the moment when Cortado passed the handkerchief to Rincon, the stranger accosted the pair. Tell me, gallant gentlemen, said he, are you admitted to the Mala Entrada, 17, or not?
17, Mala Entrada, the evil way.
We do not understand your meaning, noble sir, replied Rincon.
How? Not entered, brave merchants? Replied the other.
We are neither of Murcia 18, nor of Thebes, replied Cortado. If you have anything else to say to us, speak, if not, go your ways, and God be with you.
18, in the slang dialect of Spain, merchant and Murcia, mean thief, and the land of thieves.
Oh, your worships do not understand, don't you? Said the porter, but I will soon make you understand, and even sup up my meaning with a silver spoon. I mean to ask you, gentlemen, are your worships thieves? But why put the question, since I see well that you are thieves, and it is rather for you to tell me how it is that you have not presented yourselves at the custom house of the Señor Monipodio.
Do they then pay duty on the right of thieving in this country, gallant sewer? Exclaimed Rincon.
If they do not pay duty, at least they make them register themselves with the Señor Monipodio, who is the father, master, and protector of thieves, and I recommend you to come with me and pay your respects to him forthwith, or, if you refuse to do that, make no attempt to exercise your trade without his mark and password, or it will cost you dearly.
I thought, for my part, remarked Cortado, that the profession of thieving was a free one, exempt from all taxes and port dues, or, at least, that if we must pay, it is something to be levied in a lump, for which we give a mortgage upon our shoulders and our necks, but since it is as you say, and every land has its customs,
Let us pay due respect to this of yours. We are now in the first country of the world, and without doubt the customs of the place must be in the highest degree judicious. Wherefore your worship may be pleased to conduct us to the place where this gentleman of whom you have spoken is to be found. I cannot but suppose, from what you say, that he is much honored, of great power and influence, of very generous nature, and, above all, highly accomplished in the profession.
Honored, generous, and accomplished, do you say?
Replied the boy, aye, that he is, so much so, that during the 4 years that he has held the seat of our chief and father, only four of us have suffered at Finibusteri, 19, some 30 or so, and not more, have lost leather, and but 62 have been lagged.
19, in Finibusteri, that is to say, at the gallows, or garrote, which to the thief is the end of the earth and all things.
Truly, sir, rejoined Rincon, all this is Hebrew to us, we know no more about it than we do of flying.
Let us be jogging, then, replied the newcomer, and on the way I will explain to you these and other things, which it is requisite you should know as pat as bread to mouth, and, accordingly, he explained to them a whole vocabulary of the thieves' Latin which they call Germanesco, or Jargonza, and which their guide used in the course of his lecture, by no means a short one, for the distance they had to traverse was of considerable length.
On the road, Rincon said to his new acquaintance, does your worship happen to be a thief?
Yes, replied the lad, I have that honor, for the service of God and of all good people, but I cannot boast of being among the most distinguished, since I am as yet but in the year of my novitiate.
It is news to me, remarked Cortado, that there are thieves for the service of God and of good people.
Señor, the other replied, I don't meddle with theology, but this I know, that every one may serve God in his vocation, the more so as Daddy Monipodio keeps such good order in that respect among all his children.
His must needs be a holy and edifying command, rejoined Rincon, since it enjoins thieves to serve God.
It is so holy and edifying, exclaimed the stranger, that I don't believe a better will ever be known in our trade. His orders are that we give something by way of alms out of all we steal, to buy oil for the lamp of a highly venerated image, well known in the city, and we have really seen great things result from that good work. Not many days ago, one of our cuatreros had to take 3 onzas for having come the merchant over a couple of rosnos, and although he was but a poor weak fellow, and ill of the fever to boot, he bore them all without singing out, as though they had been mere trifles. This we of the profession attribute to his particular devotion to the Virgin of the Lamp, for he was so weak, that, of his own strength, he could not have endured the first disconcerto of the hangman's wrist. But now, as I guess, you will want to know the meaning of certain words just used. I will take physic before I am sick, that is to say, give you the explanation before you ask for it.
Be pleased to know then, gentlemen, that a cuatrero is a stealer of cattle, the ansia is the question or torture. Rosnos saving your presence are asses, and the first disconcerto is the first turn of the cord which is given by the executioner when we are on the rack. But we do more than burn oil to the Virgin. There is not one of us who does not recite his rosary carefully, dividing it into portions for each day of the week. Many will not steal at all on a Friday, and on Saturdays we never speak to any woman who is called Mary.
All these things fill me with admiration, replied Cortado, but may I trouble your worship to tell me, have you no other penance than this to perform? Is there no restitution to make?
As to restitution, returned the other, it is a thing not to be mentioned, besides, it would be wholly impossible, on account of the numerous portions into which things stolen have to be divided before each one of the agents and contractors has received the part due to him. When all these have had their share, the original thief would find it difficult to make restitution. Moreover, there is no one to bid us do anything of that kind, seeing that we do not go to confession. And if letters of excommunication are out against us, they rarely come to our knowledge, because we take care not to go into the churches while the priests are reading them, unless, indeed, it be on the days of Jubilee, for then we do go, on account of the vast profits we make from the crowds of people assembled on that occasion.
And proceeding in this manner, observed Cortado, your worships think that your lives are good and holy?
Certainly.
For what is there bad in them? Replied the other lad. Is it not worse to be a heretic or a renegade? Or to kill your father or mother?
Without doubt, admitted Cortado, but now, since our fate has decided that we are to enter this brotherhood, will your worship be pleased to step out a little, for I am dying to behold this Señor Monipodio, of whose virtues you relate such fine things.
That wish shall soon be gratified, replied the stranger, nay even from this place we can perceive his house, but your worships must remain at the door until I have gone in to see if he be disengaged, since these are the hours at which he gives audience.
So be it, replied Rincon, and the thief preceding them for a short distance, they saw him enter a house which, so far from being handsome, had a very mean and wretched appearance. The two friends remained at the door to await their guide, who soon reappeared, and called to them to come in. He then bade them remain for the present in a little paved court, or patio, 20, so clean and carefully rubbed that the red bricks shone as if covered with the finest vermilion. On one side of the court was a three-legged stool, before which stood a large pitcher with a lip broken off, and on the top of the pitcher was placed a small jug equally dilapidated. On the other side lay a rush mat, and in the middle was a fragment of crockery which did service as the recipient of some sweet basil. 20. The patio, familiar to all who have visited Seville, as forming the center of the houses, and which serves in summer as the general sitting room, so to speak, of the family. The two boys examined these movables attentively while awaiting the descent of the Signor Monipodio, but finding that he delayed his appearance, Rincon ventured to put his head into one of two small rooms which opened on the court. There he saw two fencing foils, and two bucklers of cork hung upon four nails. There was also a great chest, but without a lid or anything to cover it, with three rush mats extended on the floor. On the wall in face of him was pasted a figure of Our Lady, one of the coarsest of prints, and beneath it was a small basket of straw, with a little vessel of white earthenware sunk into the wall. The basket Rincon took to be a poor box, for receiving alms, and the little basin he supposed to be a receptacle for holy water, as in truth they were. While the friends thus waited, there came into the court two young men of some 20 years each. They were clothed as students, and were followed soon afterwards by two of the basket boys or porters, and a blind man. Neither spoke a word to the other, but all began to walk up and down in the court. No long time elapsed before there also came in two old men clothed in black serge, and with spectacles on their noses, which gave them an air of much gravity, and made them look highly respectable. Each held in his hand a rosary, the beads of which made a ringing sound. Behind these men came an old woman wearing a long and ample gown, who, without uttering a word, proceeded at once to the room wherein was the figure of Our Lady. She then took holy water with the greatest devotion, placed herself on her knees before the Virgin, and after remaining there a considerable time, first kissed the soil thrice, and then rising, lifted her arms and eyes towards heaven, in which attitude she remained a certain time longer. She then dropped her alms into the little wicker case, and that done, she issued forth among the company in the patio. Finally there were assembled in the court as many as 14 persons of various costumes and different professions. Among the latest arrivals were two dashing and elegant youths with long mustachios, hats of immense brims, broad collars, stiffly starched, colored stockings, garters with great bows and fringed ends, swords of a length beyond that permitted by law, and each having a pistol in his belt, with a buckler hanging on his arm. No sooner had these men entered, than they began to look askance at Rincon and Cortado, whom they were evidently surprised to see there, as persons unknown to themselves. At length the newcomers accosted the two friends, asking if they were of the brotherhood. "We are so," replied Rincon, "and the very humble servants of your worships besides." At this moment the Signor Monipodio honored the respectable assembly with his welcome presence. He appeared to be about 45 or 46 years old, tall, and of dark complexion. His eyebrows met on his forehead, his black beard was very thick, and his eyes were deeply sunk in his head. He had come down in a shirt, through the opening of which was seen a hairy bosom, as rough and thick set as a forest of brushwood. Over his shoulders was thrown a serge cloak, reaching nearly to his feet, which were cased in old shoes, cut down to make slippers. His legs were covered with a kind of linen gaiters, wide and ample, which fell low upon his ankles. His hat was that worn by those of the Umpa, bell-formed in the crown, and very wide in the brim. 21. Across his breast was a leather baldric, supporting a broad, short sword of the Perillo fashion. 22. His hands were short and coarse, the fingers thick, and the nails much flattened. His legs were concealed by the gaiters, but his feet were of immoderate size, and the most clumsy form. In short, he was the coarsest and most repulsive barbarian ever beheld. With him came the conductor of the two friends, who, taking Rincon and Cortado each by a hand, presented them to Monipodio, saying, "These are the two good boys of whom I spoke to your worship, Signor Monipodio. May it please your worship to examine them, and you will see how well they are prepared to enter our brotherhood." "That I will do willingly," replied Monipodio. 21. The braves of the Umpa were a horde of ruffians, principally Andalusians. They formed a society ready to commit every species of wrong and violence. 22. The Perillo, or Little Dog, was the mark of Julian del Rey, a noted armorer of Toledo, by birth a Morisco. But I had forgotten to say, that when Monipodio had first appeared, All those who were waiting for him, made a deep and long reverence, the two dashing cavaliers alone excepted, who did but just touch their hats, and then continued their walk up and down the court. Monipodio also began to pace up and down the patio, and, as he did so, he questioned the new disciples as to their trade, their birthplace, and their parents. To this Rincon replied, "Our trade is sufficiently obvious, since we are here before your worship. As to our country, it does not appear to me essential to the matter in hand that we should declare it, any more than the names of our parents, since we are not now stating our qualifications for admission into some noble order of knighthood." "What you say, my son, is true, as well as discreet," replied Monipodio, "and it is, without doubt, highly prudent to conceal those circumstances, for if things should turn out badly, there is no need to have placed upon the books of register, and under the sign manual of the justice clerk, so-and-so, native of such a place, was hanged, or made to dance at the whipping post, on such a day, with other announcements of the like kind, which, to say the least of them, do not sound agreeable in respectable ears. Thus, I repeat, that to conceal the name and abode of your parents, and even to change your own proper appellation, are prudent measures. Between ourselves there must, nevertheless, be no concealment, for the present I will ask your names only, but these you must give me." Rincon then told his name, and so did Cortado, whereupon Monipodio said, "Henceforward I request and desire that you, Rincon, call yourself Rinconete, and you, Cortado, Cortadillo, these being names which accord, as though made in a mold, with your age and circumstances, as well as with our ordinances, which make it needful that we should also know the names of the parents of our comrades, because it is our custom to have a certain number of masses said every year for the souls of our dead, and of the benefactors of our society, and we provide for the payment of the priests who say them, by setting apart a share of our swag for that purpose. These masses, thus said and paid for, are of great service to the souls aforesaid. Among our benefactors we count the alguazil, who gives us warning, the advocate, who defends us, the executioner, who takes pity upon us when we have to be whipped, and the man who, when we are running along the street, and the people in full cry after us bawling stop thief, throws himself between us and our pursuers, and checks the torrent, saying, 'Let the poor wretch alone, his lot is hard enough, let him go, and his crime will be his punishment.' We also count among our benefactors the good wenches who aid us by their labors while we are in prison, or at the galleys, our fathers, and the mothers who brought us into the world, and, finally, we take care to include the clerk of the court, for if he befriend us, there is no crime which he will not find means to reduce to a slight fault, and no fault which he does not prevent from being punished. For all these our brotherhood causes the sanctimonies, ceremonies, I have named to be solemnized, every year, with all possible grandiloquence." "Certainly," replied Rinconete, now confirmed in that name, "certainly that is a good work, and entirely worthy of the lofty and profound genius with which we have heard that you, Señor Monipodio, are endowed. Our parents still enjoy a life, but should they precede us to the tomb, we will instantly give notice of that circumstance to this happy and highly esteemed fraternity, to the end that you may have sanctimonies solecised for their souls, as your worship is pleased to say, with the customary grandiloquence." "And so shall it be done," returned Monipodio, "if there be but a piece of me left alive to look to it." He then called their conductor, saying, "Hello! There, Ganquelo. 23, is the watch set?" "Yes," replied the boy, "3 sentinels are on guard, and there is no fear of a surprise." "Let us return to business, then," said Monipodio. "I would fain know from you, my sons, what you are able to do, that I may assign you an employment in conformity with your inclinations and accomplishments." 23, Ganquelo is the diminutive of Gancho, a crimp. "I," replied Rinconete, "know a trick or two to gammon a bumpkin, I am not a bad hand at hiding what a pal has prigged, I have a good eye for a gudgeon, I play well at most games of cards, and have all the best turns of the pasteboard at my finger ends, I have cut my eye teeth, and am about as easy to lay hold of as a hedgehog, I can creep through a cat hole or down a chimney, as I would enter the door of my father's house, and will muster a million of tricks better than I could marshal a regiment of soldiers, and flabbergast the knowingest cove a deal sooner than pay back a loan of 2 reals. These are certainly the rudiments," admitted Monipodio, "but all such things are no better than old lavender flowers, so completely worn out of all savor that there is not a novice who may not boast of being a master in them. They are good for nothing but to catch simpletons who are stupid enough to run their heads against the church steeple, but time will do much for you, and we must talk further together. On the foundation already laid you shall have half a dozen lessons, and I then trust in God that you will turn out a famous craftsman, and even, mayhap, a master.
My abilities shall always be at your service, and that of the gentlemen who are our comrades, replied Rinconete, and Monipodio then turned towards Cortadillo.
And you, Cortadillo, what may you be good for? He inquired, to which Cortadillo replied, for my part I know the trick called put in two, and take out five, and I can dive to the bottom of a pocket with great precision and dexterity.
Do you know nothing more? Continued Monipodio.
Alas, no, for my sins, that is all I can do, admitted Cortadillo,
do not afflict yourself.
Nevertheless, said the master, you are arrived at a good port, where you will not be drowned, and you enter a school in which you can hardly fail to learn all that is requisite for your future welfare. And now as to courage, how do you feel yourselves provided in that